You know what I don't like about internet conspiracy theories is you guys are really out here, like,
I think these billionaires might be up to something. I think they might be doing dark, depraved, demonic rituals in secret.
Oh yeah, you think the people that are openly profiting from child slavery all day, every day might secretly be up to no good? The people that start proxy wars to control labor and resources, literally causing the death and suffering of millions and millions of people? Interesting observation. Tell me, what was your first clue that they might not be entirely on the level? The ones who assassinate whistleblowers, the ones who knowingly poison the food and water supply, then cover it up for as long as they can, and then when they do get caught, they get away with like a slap on the wrist and a small fine because they've also bought the system that's supposed to be holding them accountable. Meanwhile, you're out here like,
their business's logo has a triangle in it. I doubt that's a coincidence.
Why are you scouring internet rabbit holes for evidence that these people are also, like, dressing up in colorful robes and dripping candle wax on each other's nipples in the name of some demon or whatever? Why does that make it worse? I mean, I'm not saying they're not doing those things, and sure, maybe the Epstein Files thing might crack the top 50 horrific things these people are objectively up to on a regular basis. You don't need evidence of a secret society to know that these people are monsters. Society is the evidence that these people are monsters.
This is Bristol. It's Friday the 28th of November 2025. We've got a bit of a novel show for you this week. Not quite live, nearly. But not quite. Hopefully, it'll be interesting to hear what feedback there is on this way of doing things, because I think we've got an interesting show. Well, you know, I'm sure we have. Nevertheless, don't believe anything we say, of course, or I say. But we're going to take a bit of an adventure this week, doing something slightly different by looking around and also going through the firewall to check RT. After the break, we'll have a talk with three amazing people. I couldn't believe it quite when I saw all three of them. Matt Errett, with Peter Lavelle, also Patrick Henningsen and Alex Craner, all talking about the wrangling between the United States and Europe over whether this Ukraine war is going to carry on or not, and what the point of it all is. Excellent discussion from them. Also, a look at the budget, a pretty thorough look, including the most important, in my view, thing going on right now in terms of money, which is the farmers, the family farmers being destroyed by Rachel Reeves and BlackRock and their little office in the Treasury, which they say is not there, but the Treasury has a special BlackRock private equity liaison office now. The Financial Times revealed that earlier in 2025. We'll also be hearing from Nigel Farage. Because I don't know if you noticed this week, there's a very weird story about someone saying that he said Hitler was a good guy when he was at Dulwich College, when he was in his teens, and he was a bully of some sort. But this story is not corroborated, it's not had any proper tests of veracity, it's just somebody saying it. And apparently there's 20 more people that say it too, who we're not allowed to know who they are. But anyway, of course, the BBC shouldn't be running, or nobody else, anyone else shouldn't be running stories like this, which are just basically scurrilous gossip. It may be true, but you've got to actually test these things. And potentially, Farage is now going to be launching some sort of libel action against this person. And so at the end of that, we will know if this was worth putting on the news or not. But it seems to me obvious that since Farage is likely to form the next government, if he's still alive, that we should be hearing about his views on the budget. Now, we already know earlier this year that he's scared the Treasury by saying that maybe these private loans, which we're repaying massive amounts of at the moment, the £3 billion the British government is in debt, that we wouldn't have to be paying any interest because we could just print money and pay off those loans and then pay no interest to the Bank of England. These are very important things. The Bank of England immediately said, oh, no, we can't do that. But then, you know, that is actually a fairly sensible idea and it needs to be properly looked at. But no. Anyway, so Farage been completely cut out of the mainstream press coverage of the budget, pretty much. So we'll be hearing a bit from him about that. Also, a look at the Greens. I mean, I'm always more interested in the fringe parties. Plus a very special guest. Anyway, let's crack on. By the way, also a lot about the occult this week. But since Martin's not around, I managed to sneak in quite a lot. There's a guy called C.J. Hopkins, who's an American guy working in Berlin, and he's come out with a book which is accusing the German government of behaving like the Nazis, and he's being harassed by them. And he points out very rightly that, well, you're calling the Alternative for Deutschland Nazis all the time, all over the mainstream press. The police aren't coming for you, are they? And then we do something, I don't think we've ever done this quite before, which is going back to this amazing and brilliant series. And I think maybe over the next few weeks we'll have extracts from the four programmes. It's called The Occult History of the Third Reich. This one is an excerpt from The Enigma of the Swastika. So two good ones to have together. And we'll be rounding up, as I promised last week, with David Livingstone talking about Nick Land, from Nick Land to Charles Manson, or the other way around, possibly. And also Cynthia Chung with Matt Errett again. So he gets a double appearance on the Breaking History podcast. So let's get cracking. First of all, we're going to start, though, with this horrible attack this week on trial by jury. One group of people that are getting a trial by jury, even though they've been interned on remand, they haven't been allowed out. This is the Filton Five, been accused of all sorts of things, including laying into, rather stupidly, if there's any truth to that, police with a sledgehammer. I mean, you don't do that. Anyone like myself who's ever done non-violent direct action training, is you, the last thing in the world you want to do is attack the police. This is a stupid thing to do. If it's true, what you do, you're there to destroy equipment, and then as soon as the authorities turn up, you just hand yourself over. Some of them apparently managed to get away. But anyway, this is something that certainly in the 90s and noughties was well known by non-violent direct activists. I think some of the Palestine Action people from Filton maybe had been through some alternative type of training or something. But anyway, let's have a listen now to my favourite witch, which she is. But anyway, she says loads of great things. It's Ali McForever looking at the hunger strike of these Filton people who are being taken to task for smashing up drones being used by the Israelis at Filton here in Bristol.
Six people are starving to death in British prisons right now. They are Tayuta Hoja, Cameron Ahmed, Kesser Zura, Amu Jib, Hibat Morassi, and John Sink. The government will not let them go to trial, will not let them out on bail, and will not stop arming Israel. They have been refusing food since the 2nd of November. Today is the 22nd of November. That's 3 weeks. By now, their bodies are eating themselves. Their hearts are breaking down. They could die today, tomorrow, next week. They are not convicted criminals. They have not had a trial. They have been locked up for over a year waiting. Normal legal limit for somebody waiting in jail pre-trial is 182 days. They have blown past that. But the government is holding them anyway. What did they do? They broke into Elbit factory in Filton and spray painted some planes. No one was hurt. They damaged property. Property that belongs to the company that builds the bombs that are killing thousands of people in Gaza. Elbit is an Israeli arms company. It supplies the Israeli military. The activists smashed windows, damaged equipment, and spray-painted walls. They were trying to bring attention to Britain's role in the genocide. They were arrested the same day in violent raids. When counter-terrorism police arrested Cameron Ahmed, it was at dawn. And they denied his elderly parents food and medication for hours. Kamran is their only carer. He's not expected to face trial until June 2026. David Sink is not expected to face trial until January 2027. Amu Jib, also known as Amy Gibson, was put into solitary confinement by guards at Bronzefield for embroidering Free Palestine on a cushion. They report regular use of solitary confinement on people who have not been charged of any crimes. While the others are being held in Bronzefield in Surrey, Hepa was transferred hundreds of miles to Yorkshire and is being held in Wakefield Prison. Campaigners describe this as a deliberate punishment known as ghosting, but it's basically exile. They've moved her away from London where her family is and alienated this person. Again, no charges. And they confiscated her hijab. T is 29 years old and being held in Peterborough. She's not expected to get a trial date until April next year. She has a 17-year-old sister named Rama, who she helped study for her GCSEs from inside prison. Rama got her highest grade in GCSE English this summer, while T was on her first hunger strike. She refused food for 22 days in August and told visitors, "Don't worry about me." But her body carries the damage of that first hunger strike. She weighs 50 kg. Here's what happens to your body when you stop eating. From days 1 to 3, your body uses the sugar stored in your muscles and your liver. You feel weak, dizzy, and have headaches. Your blood sugar drops. From days 3 to 10, your body switches to burning fat. This is called ketosis. In this phase, you lose weight quickly, but you feel shit, exhausted, irritable, and faint. Your blood pressure starts dropping and you can pass out. After day 10, your body runs out of fat. At this point, it starts to eat your muscles, including your heart. Your heart is a muscle. This makes your heart weaker. Even if you survive, bouts of starvation will weaken your heart muscle indefinitely. You keep getting weaker and then your immune system starts to collapse. Your body cannot balance its own chemistry anymore. And so in the balance of the electrolytes, things can start to go wrong. The amount of potassium, sodium, and magnesium that your body needs to function is an exact science. This is why reintroducing food can now also cause you to die. If the body is starved and then suddenly gets food again, that sudden shift in chemistry causes heart failure and seizures. Refeeding requires medical supervision. It needs to be slow and these electrolytes need monitoring. When Amu started their strike, their weight plummeted 5 kgs in 7 days. They were denied medical care and the prison barred them from using the gym. Prison officials gave Hubba Morassi a detailed medical explanation of exactly how her organs are going to break down and graphic detail of what will happen to her body during hunger strike. This is psychological pressure. This is the person they've alienated in Yorkshire. So she's being gaslit by the prison services. Kesser was 19 when she was arrested. And when she announced her hunger strike, 5 prison guards manhandled her. They forced her into a cell and instructed other prisoners not to help her. Prison staff refused her request for electrolytes, with a nurse telling her they do not consider it a hunger strike until she stops drinking water. Let's compare this treatment to other crimes. What can you get bail for in Britain? Well, you can kill someone drunk driving and get bail. You can commit fraud worth millions and get bail. You can beat someone unconscious outside a nightclub and get bail. Rolf Harris, convicted of 12 counts of indecent assault against children, got bail and walked free until his court date. Gary Glitter, the convicted pedophile, was granted multiple bails. In 2023, a man in London was convicted of rape. He got bail. While on bail, he raped again. Bail is routinely granted for violent offences, sexual offences, serious fraud. Because the legal principle is simple. You are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. Remand, which is holding someone in jail before trial, is supposed to be rare. Only used when someone is a flight risk or a danger to the public. What did the Filton 24 do? They broke windows and spray-painted planes. No one was hurt. No one was threatened. They filmed it and posted it online. So they are clearly not trying to hide. Yet they have been in jail, no bail, no trial, no conviction for over a year. And they are now on hunger strike. and they are being grossly mishandled and abused by the prison services. Let's talk about the people who sell those weapons, shall we? Elbit? Over 40,000 Palestinians dead, at least, since October 2023. Elbit system weapons are used by Israel to bomb hospitals, schools, people in tents. Their executives are not in jail. They are not on trial. The Ministry of Defence is preparing to award Elbit a £2 billion contract. They provide electronic warfare systems to the Royal Navy. Israel wouldn't exist without British backing. Two former senior Ministry of Defence officials now sit on Elbit's board. Sir Simon Bolam and Sir Mark Poffley. That is called the revolving door. While technically legal, it is incredibly ethically corrupt. Moving from a government job into a company that benefits from a government contract is not okay. Especially when it's the war industry. So, the people who make the bombs that kill the children get government contracts and knighthoods? And the people trying to bring awareness to that fact die starving in jail without trial. The government needs to drop the terrorist framing, grant them bail, and set court dates. In any functioning legal system, the trials would have happened months ago. The prescription of Palestine action is a gross misuse of illegitimate power. Let's be clear. A misinformed public voted in a Labour government, and that Labour government sold them out to Trevor Chin. Banning a non-violent protest group as terrorism, while you sanction the use of Darvo tactics on activists in British jails, is a legal and moral disgrace. You are not a person without power. Share this video. Talk about these people. Do not let the silence continue. Silence is what the British government is counting on. They think that you will not notice when six people die for their rights in a British jail. They think you will not care. Prove them wrong.
So that's Ali McForever talking about the Filton Five and their hunger strike. Straight on to Farage. As I said, it's annoying not to hear his take, since they're going to be the next government, most likely. At least that's what the polls are suggesting, on this year's budget. Of course, he's probably going to do a better job than the Conservatives in criticising it. And amazing to see that these Dulwich College accusations about what happened there have basically completely kicked him off the news this week. And it seems this is a psyop. It looks to me very obviously like a psyop of some kind. So let's listen to hear and see what Farage's take on the budget was.
Good afternoon. Well, one thing that was very clear to me watching the budget was that we are in an economic doom loop and no one seems to recognise it. Neither the last Conservative government nor this Labour government. There isn't really much truth being spoken about just how much trouble we're in. But there was one absolute truth that came from Rachel Reeves this morning, and that was that this government had a very bad inheritance. Just think of it, tax levels at post-war highs, mass uncontrolled immigration, most people coming, not actually working, and being a burden and a massive cost, net zero policies, deindustrialising Britain at a rapid rate, giving us the most expensive energy in the world. And generally, debt, which went up about 2.5 times during those 14 years. So the economic inheritance that Labour had was poor. And whatever the Tory leader stands up and says in the House of Commons doesn't do anything to take that away. But I have to say, I sat there thinking this really was the Alice through the looking glass budget, with a healthy dose of socialism thrown in. Yes, words mean what I say they mean, not what they really mean. She talks about growth, and yet the projections for the next few years, growth is continually being downgraded. And quite how she and the Prime Minister, they literally talked repeatedly about cutting debt. Cutting debt. And yet, even in their first year, they borrowed £21 billion, more than they were forecast to borrow before they even started. And the parts that I found really difficult to swallow, she talked about entrepreneurs, supporting entrepreneurs, not understanding that actually entrepreneurial people are generally deciding not to stay in this country, let alone invest in this country. And then the sort of classic phrase, no doubt fed to her by the Treasury, that we're stabilising the economy. Well, I was in North Wales earlier this week, and having met with local businesses, family businesses, farmers, I certainly got the feeling that the economy in certain parts of this country is very much on the edge of a precipice. So none of what she really said today was true. Taxes, well, I mentioned them already, but they're now up to 38%, just over 38% of GDP. She's managed to increase taxes in the space of just over a year, nearly more than any other chancellor in history, and they had much longer to do this. Well, we're very, very clear that we genuinely are on the side of alarm clock Britain, because here's the problem. Who is going to pay all these increased taxes? Not just the frozen thresholds, they're bad enough, but all the other taxes, whether it's on taxes on taxes or whatever else it may be, basically working people are going to be subsidising a welfare bill that shows no sign of going down whatsoever. Indeed, the Rachel Rees version of abolishing the two-child cap will cost over £3 billion. Our plan to get rid of it for working British couples would have cost a mere £300 million every year. And if you look at the projections, they're quite clear to admit that net migration by the end of this parliament will go up to over a third of a million a year, and that on net zero, there is absolutely no acceptance from the government whatsoever of the vast damage that net zero is doing. And all you've got to do is, you know, talk to the Jim Ratcliffe of this world, who are closing down, who is at the moment closing down the biggest manufacturing plant left in Scotland, to realise the sheer damage this is doing. And yet they're going to continue with their net zero plans. In fact, they're actually going to accelerate them. I would very much sum up this budget as an assault on aspiration and an assault on saving. Quite frankly, what she's done with voluntary contributions to pensions will, I think, kill off the SIP market, the self-invested pension plan. I think today's budget will literally kill that off and do damage to the private pension market, pretty much equivalent to what Gordon Brown did 25 years ago when he put tax on dividend earnings, which then couldn't be fully reinvested. Unnoticed, perhaps, in some areas, dividend taxes up yet again. And, you know, why would you invest if you feel there's a never-ending cycle of taxes on profits going up? Not to mention the mansion tax, which won't affect many people, but no doubt there'll be some widows living in Greater London that will be caused great distress by it. My big prediction from this budget is that the exodus will continue. They've got rid of the non-doms, well done. People that spend vast amounts of money in this country, that employ people, invest in people, they've gone. Many of our highest taxpayers, and bear in mind that 1% now pay 30% of all income tax, they're going. But worst of all of these signals from a government that literally doesn't understand business, because none of them have ever been in business, and frankly, there are few in the opposition who tick that box either. Now, my prediction is the exodus will continue, the exodus will accelerate, and the tragedy of it is the sheer number of 30-somethings who want to work hard, who want to do well, who are ambitious, and for them, they're seeing the Gulf. They're even seeing, ironically, other European countries. Milan in Italy being perhaps a very good example where young, hard-working entrepreneurs are going. That's one very, very big prediction that I've got from this budget. And the other one is, don't be deceived by being told that bills will go down. The big reach-out pledge of this budget, frozen train fares, yes, for those that commute, but energy bills, that's the big push from the government in this budget. Your energy bills will go down by £150. Bear in mind, this is the government that said they'd reduce energy bills by £300, and they're up almost exactly £300. The £150 reduction will be where they take some of the green subsidies, about three quarters of the green subsidies off domestic energy bills and throw that into general taxation, which means the working population will actually pay even more than we thought when I walked out of the chamber just some time ago. Energy clearly is going to be at the centrepiece of everything we fight for and stand for over the next couple of years. We cannot have an industrial strategy. We cannot reindustrialise. We cannot invite significant investment, be it British or be it foreign, until first we crack the nut of energy. And I would say this, you know, we can't perform miracles if we win the next election, but we can at least be realistic. And we can at least say that already within reform we have people who've succeeded in the private sector, who've created jobs, who've paid taxes. And it's very much our ambition that we would have people in ministerial positions who were experts in their areas of expertise. Getting back to energy, just think about it. 10 energy ministers over the course of 14 years under a Conservative government, not one of them had a clue about energy. Just allowing civil servants to go on running these departments and maintaining a failed status quo. So we will come in with people that actually know what they're doing, the people who have worked in the private sector, and we will attempt to turn around attitudes in this country towards hard work and success.
Hi, Anya Pop, Channel 4 News. Mr. Farage, 20 people have accused you of making racist comments at school.
Oh dear, I think we've gone quite a long way towards answering all this, don't you?
But you've mentioned three people with political affiliations. What about the other 17? Why should people believe you over
them? Well, if you
them?
Look at what they said, none of them say I directly attack them or abuse them. What they do say very clearly is they had different political views to me. That I thought Enoch Powell was right about the common market, which I did in the referendum, which was a minority position, but I held it all the way back then. And I thought he was right to talk about, you know, not having vast community change. And by the way, you know, that was a source of big political debate back in the late 1970s. So I think what you're hearing there, yes, some with direct political involvement, others with different political views. And by the way, you know, look at the level of debate in Britain today. I mean, anyone that dares to question immigration numbers is likely to be screamed at as racist in the street. So perhaps not much has in some ways actually changed.
Farage's take on Rachel Reeves's budget this week. Well, you know, he's an idiot. Sorry to say that. But, you know, you can't have just private sector running everything unless you want to have a people farm or a people factory for a country. I'd much rather see sensible socialist economists such as people like Steve Keane, who we'll be hearing from a little bit later. But anyway, that's Farage's take. As for the Greens,
can a woman have a penis?
Yes. It's going to take them a long time on the National Health Service to get rid of it, but all that's right. Another separate problem.
I think we'll leave it on a woman can have a penis.
You're lacking nuance and complexity about a pretty complicated
conversation. Not really. You couldn't have been clearer. Ask a simple question.
But you're laughing at it, which I think demeans trans people.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous.
What have you got against
response?
Trans people? Why are you punching down? Why are you not saying
nothing against
the real
trans
problem
people.
In
I've
this
already
country?
Told you that I think trans people...
You sound like you have a huge problem with trans people.
No. It sounds to me like you don't understand what a woman is, which I think is a huge problem for someone leading a party in this country.
A woman is a gender.
Sorry? A woman is a
is
biological
gender a spectrum?
Female.
Is it that binary?
Do you think people are born male and female?
Not necessarily.
Oh, for God's sake.
I think it's more complicated than
it's
that.
It's not more complicated.
Well, that's Zach Polanski. I mean, you know, anyone that thinks things like that, really, I mean, he's a saboteur, isn't he? Just like the... a person who we're about to hear from the top of the BBC, Robbie Gibb. So, Zach Polanski, well done. You know, you haven't really got it, mate, even though the Greens are supposed to be, you know, into the environment. It seems they're more into strange activities of actually convincing yourself, well, not just cross-dressing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, potentially. But, well, nothing wrong with that. Some people think it's fine. Is actually convincing yourself and everybody else that you are the opposite sex to what you actually are. This is mental illness, in my view. So it's great, isn't it, to have someone like that running the Greens. I wonder if there's a conspiracy to be seen there. But anyway, we're going to hear now from former newsreader Anna Ford, who's been looking at the Israel lobby and Robbie Gibb at the top of the BBC, who's caused this massive crisis. Of course, what they do is they put dodgy people in charge in order to sabotage it.
This is Broadcasting House, home of the BBC. And this is Sir Robbie Gibb, a member of the Corporation's Board of Directors. The BBC has come under fire recently after an internal report detailed how it spliced together two clips of Donald Trump on January 6, 2021. The report also accused the BBC of being biased against Israel. Shortly after the Daily Telegraph published the report, the BBC's Director General and Head of News resigned. And who was the driving force behind those resignations? According to newspaper reports, it was Robbie Gibb. Gibb claims to be on a mission to root out bias at the BBC. So who is this self-styled paragon of impartiality? He describes himself as a proper Thatcherite conservative who once served as the Conservative Prime Minister, Theresa May's Downing Street Head of Communications. After that, he helped launch GB News, the TV channel whose presenters include Nigel Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg. Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson then appointed Gibb to the BBC board, where he took on a key role overseeing editorial standards. Conservative activist Robbie Gibb had a mission to root out bias. One newspaper quoted him as saying that if he didn't get his way, he would, quote, blow the place up. When Gibb was handed his role at the BBC, he had to fill in a form declaring his financial interests. In it, he wrote that he was the 100% owner of the Jewish Chronicle newspaper. The paper had just been bought by a consortium, but Gibb has never revealed who put up the money. So what happened when this figurehead of BBC impartiality took over at the Jewish Chronicle? The paper became a vocal supporter of the Netanyahu government and was plagued by ethical and editorial lapses, which led five leading columnists to resign. One of them, Jonathan Friedland, said, quote, "Too often the JC reads like a partisan, ideological instrument, its judgments political rather than journalistic." A reminder, Sir Robbie Gibb is now the arbiter of supposed BBC bias on Israel-Palestine. The internal report that started the recent controversy was written by a man called Michael Prescott, a former Rupert Murdoch employee who is reportedly a friend of Robbie Gibb. The BBC has its flaws, but it's still the most trusted broadcaster in the world and an institution worth protecting. Yet the man who sits on its board, supposedly enforcing impartiality, is a conservative political activist who owned a newspaper on behalf of secret donors that became known for inaccurate, ideological, and deeply biased content. There are many fine journalists working in this building who are committed on a deep level to impartiality. So Robbie Gibb, it would appear, is not one of them.
Anna Ford there, giving you, former newsreader, giving you the real news. Of course, she's been kept off the news. Annoying, isn't it? The real people that really know what's going on. She's not far away from being a well-known newsreader, but no, she wouldn't be allowed to say that anywhere near the mainstream television, would she? Now on to a bit of a special now, and my special guest this week. That is to say, Richie Allen. He had a bit of a problem in his studio at the beginning of this week. Some little piece of electronics blew a gasket, and so he's not been able to do his show, live show, as he normally does. And, of course, you can get his app from richieallen.co.uk. Anyway, let's have a listen to... I had a real good chat with Richie this week, and I first of all asked him about what happened to his studio.
Richie Allen here, glad to be here, presenter of the Richie Allen Show, Monday to Thursday, 5 p.m, currently off air temporarily, not for long, due to a technical glitch with something called a core unit, which is like a server for digital broadcast consoles. Something went wrong with it, and it's unfortunate, and I can't do anything until it is repaired and returned to me.
Can't you just plug a new one in?
No, don't you start. No, I'm not the BBC. I don't have two, three studios, production studios and stuff like that. So I have what I have. I mean, I could go a very rudimentary way, but I've always been somebody who's been incredibly precious about production values and sound. So I just won't do that. Like, the show spent a lot of money on the studio that it currently has. It's very good. The company AEQ is a world leader in radio broadcasting facilities. And it's just unlucky, 3 years into my kind of journey with this particular broadcast console. We've just had a little bit of a glitch, and it's just one of those things.
So you haven't been hacked. That's what everyone.
Oh God, no,
thinking.
No, no.
Look, I mean, the thing is, this what we're doing is incredibly fragile, really, in a way, Richie. Isn't
yeah.
It? Because it could be at any moment. Anybody, GCHQ, obviously it would be the Russians doing it. That's could go just like that. The old days of FM transmitters, that was a little bit more difficult to stop, or even meaning long wave transmitters. But the internet's quite vulnerable, which is why I'm quite interested maybe to talk here today about the role of this sort of live talk radio sort of thing that we do. In getting information out, because this is, it seems to me, in a way, is becoming the front line. As the West is hemmed in various different directions, militarily by the Chinese, the Russians, et cetera, people getting onto them, they don't really want to do deals with them anymore. They don't see them as honest brokers. So that battle has been transferred, it seems to me, to the airwaves.
Yes, and we are very vulnerable. I mean, I've bored my listeners to death for about 5 years, warning them of a looming threat to what it is we do, which is what we're doing right now, broadcasting online, which is where we have to do it. It's where everybody does it now. FM is pretty much dead, and it is very vulnerable. It's vulnerable because we are depending on, well, external help all the time. We exist on servers, mostly on other people's servers. We use streaming services. I use a third-party service to manufacture and distribute my own app, because I have an app where people listen to my program. And I have no doubt that in the near future, it's going to be squeezed. It's going to become more and more difficult to do what it is we do. There's no doubt about that. You know,
it can be shut down just like that, really. I mean, these people are pros, the cyber warfare types. We've got a massive organisation at Cheltenham that I was just hearing this week maybe actually runs the country. It's called GCHQ. It used to be Bletchley Park. In the States, it's the National Security Agency. So, I mean, we have to just cross our fingers sometimes and hope that there's decent people in these organisations that can see what we can see, which is the rot, particularly in the Western elite, who seem to be trying to kick off wars. But anyway, look, we're here to talk about what's really in the news. We've had the budget this week, which is one of the most travesties I've ever seen. This idea that we're not going to increase income tax, but I tell you what, we're going to start pushing those thresholds down and down, down the line.
Yeah.
So more and more and more people are being pushed up into medium and higher rates of paying income tax. And then, of course, once they've got their money and they've spent it on something, maybe bought a house or a car, that those are all going to be taxed, the inheritance tax on the houses, et cetera, et cetera. So we're being really squeezed down. The money that, you know, as when you buy something that's taxed, the point here I'm coming to eventually, hopefully, is that the finance correspondent, I get more and more irritated, Richie. It'd be great to hear your views on the finance correspondents from London, you know, the TV people, the Faisal Islam types, the Ben Chus, who built a career on explaining what's going on financially. They seem to me to be just total tools now of the Bank of England, the Treasury and the City of London.
One of the things I used to do during my many years of working in commercial radio and national radio was I was often asked to explain this stuff to listeners, because for some reason I was able to kind of grasp what was being said and what it meant. That's not to big myself up. Most of the time I don't have a clue what's going on. But when it comes to financial services, when it comes to the economy and taxation, I've got a kind of an idea. And I certainly have an idea in terms of what I believe to be happening right now. So this budget, right? So we knew before the announcement of the budget, it was trailed for weeks on end, right? What did we know, people like you and me? Well, we knew that no chancellor could make any meaningful cuts to spending, not in reality. Why? Because around about three quarters of spending at the moment is already locked into things like pensions and benefits. That's 75%. There's very little you can do to any of that, meaning that Reeves, and this is if we believe Reeves is in charge. Of course, you know, I don't. You can take that on if you like. Of course, this is your show. Or maybe we'll leave that for another day. I don't believe any of these people are in charge. They do what they're told and they say what they're told to say. So what does it mean? It means, as far as I understand it, there is hardly any room for manoeuvre at all in terms of making savings through cutting spending. So what does that mean? If you can't save through cutting spending, it means that tax rises are an inevitability, right? So we said last July when we butted heads before the election, this notion of protecting working people was an absolute nonsense, because governments over the last 20 years and the media you just mentioned, by the way, have deliberately kept hidden from people the true scale of the financial liabilities, like the public sector pensions and so on, right? And benefits and all of that. So ultimately, the UK and most Western democracies, you might argue, Tony, or I would argue anyway, they've become hooked on borrowing and unsustainable borrowing. And at the moment, and funnily enough, before my technical mishap, I've been speaking quite a bit about this on the programme. UK debt is now nearly 100% of GDP. And before Reeves' budget, the tax burden was at a post-war high, Tony, I think. And at the same time, core public services, vital public services, NHS, et cetera, are still crumbling. Mutual friend of ours, John Perkins, who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, he would describe this as the death economy. You can't tax your way to growth. You can't. So I believe, oh, and by the way, at the same time, artificial intelligence is going to do more white collar jobs than even we could imagine, meaning that where will tax revenues come from in the future? So this is massive. And I believe it's all part of a horrible authoritarian dystopian plan to transform us from the financial system that we understand at the moment, fractional reserve banking, into something completely different. That's what, and something incredibly controlled, namely digital, central bank digital currencies, universal basic incomes to keep people quiet and to pacify them when everything goes belly up, as I have no doubt it will. In a nutshell, that's where I see it.
This thing called programmable money as well, which is sitting there waiting to go. So the idea, it seems to me, to be to crash things. You know, they know that there's going to be a crash at some point, so that's what they're going to do. But anyway, look, from trying to say something positive, this is what these London Finance, Bank of England, City of London stooges, they're public relations people for the city, are this weird thing, you know, the Guildhall. By the way, Sam William has been doing some brilliant things I've seen online recently, wandering around places like the Bank of England, Temple in London, looking at all the occult symbolism. Nobody else has been really, I think, pulling that apart as humorously as he's been doing. So the things they could do, what could they do that they're not talking about? This is the taboos. These are things, I think, Richie, things that you and I are interested in. Let's just break a couple of taboos. Let's say renationalise all the things which were nationalised by Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, the infrastructure of the country, because all of this is being used to really screw us down, whether it's rail fares, the cost of living crisis, gas, electricity, water,
water.
So that's the first thing. And by the way, it's not a difficult thing to do. What you do is you just regulate the private businesses into the ground so they can't make money, and then it falls back into the hands. So you don't have to pay a penny for it. So Rachel Reeves and the Treasury don't even need to get involved in that one. But secondly, the Bank of England can print money. They should print money. And why on earth don't they print money? If they want to spend... Farage pointed this out, right, earlier this year. He said all this money that we're paying interest on, isn't it the $3 trillion debt? This, we don't need to be paying interest at all. If we print money from the Bank of England, pay off that debt, and then just repay the money back to the Bank of England at zero interest. He pointed this out. The Bank of England immediately said, no, you can't do that. So it's interesting that Farage, for all his evils, is coming out with some of these taboo-breaking things. The other taboo he broke, of course, last year, was saying that NATO provoked Russia to invade Ukraine. And we've seen just over the last few days the fallback and the comeback for that is that his Welsh leader has been jailed for 10 years.
That's right.
For taking money from Russia. Now, of course, if... if this was a principle, which of course it isn't, how many people, Richie, in London would be in jail for taking money for Israel, I wonder?
Well, yeah, the population of London would be reduced at the speed of light, wouldn't it, if that was the case? Yeah, it's a very interesting story, that. And Farage is a very interesting character. For me, and I know you disagree with this, but that's fine, Farage is typical of the... Well, he's a typical populist, isn't he? He's a typical populist rabble-rouser, I would say, who has the luxury of a 3.5-4 year lead into an election whereby he can promise the world the moon and the stars, Tony. But like pretty much every other populist, including the most famous of them all or the most infamous of them all, Donald Trump, they deliver nothing once they eventually... I do believe reform, despite the attacks on Farage at the moment, which are fairly ridiculous, these attacks about things he's supposedly said to fellow students 50 years ago.
Well, yeah, that was very important timing, Richie. I think that was just exactly as the budget is released. So the whole Farage thing is dominated by these. And I was listening to the coverage of
Fair enough. I know what you're saying. I'm not necessarily what I'm saying.
There's somebody here. Who the hell are they? These allegations have not been tested at all. They didn't name the people. They said on the bulletin, I think it was...
Well, they have done now. They have They've named one specific guy. He's a filmmaker,
isn't
it?
But they're saying, oh, the reason we're running this is because the other people have backed it up, but they're not saying who they are. So this, to me, smacks of a psyop to completely kick Farage out of any of the budget discussions.
Yeah, you could very well be right, mate. Yeah, look, I'm not going to argue with that because it is fairly plausible. I'm not stubborn. I still wouldn't change my mind on if Farage was to avoid any scandal at all and form part of the next government as a coalition. For me, it wouldn't make any difference. And you know this because you've been a guest on my shows for over a decade, going back to my days in Spain. Dominic Cummings hinted at this stuff, amazingly, a year or so ago, when he said, look, they don't have really any power. The real power lies in the hands of the civil servants and the think tanks and other actors and parties.
Because they do have power. It's just that they choose not to use it. I mean, I've been on the boards of big organisations, you know, sort of multi-million pound businesses where you're sitting around a board table and you can tell, you look around the room and you can pick out at least four or five of the people around the room who don't actually give a damn about the people that are at the bottom of the pyramid that they're managing. All they want to do is get to the end of the meeting quickly and have some sandwiches. And, you know, what we need is people running organisations that actually do think and care.
Yeah, but we've always disagreed on this, and I think we always will. Elected governments do not have any power whatsoever. The proof of the pudding is not even in the eating. It should be self-evident to everybody who observes or participates in politics or geopolitics. They don't have any power. Look at the Labour manifesto last year. Look at the manifestos of the previous prime ministers, whether it be, forget Liz Truss, whether it be Sunak, going back before Sunak Johnson, before that you had Theresa May. The realities in terms of what governments actually do, as opposed to the black and white text of the manifestos, they couldn't be any further apart. And that is because when elected governments take office, it is made abundantly clear to them very early on from the civil servants who've been running their departments forever. No, you won't be doing any of that which you promised your constituents or
what happens
your members.
When you've got a politician who immediately says, oh, you, right, it's when someone tells them that, you're sacked.
Assassination.
Because we do
assassination
have.
Assassination or disgrace.
Maybe. And I think a lot of people like Trump, for example, maybe Farage too, are quite aware that they could be bumped off, but they're prepared to actually put their lives on the line, maybe. And so this is a big ask from anybody, which is why we've got, I think, a crisis in politics. We need people of character in those positions who are prepared to actually lead.
I think what's coming down the line, if you're going to allow me say so, I know you will, because I do reciprocate on my show. I think what's coming, Tony, and it's been planned, I believe, for a long time, and I say this of my own volition, it isn't because I've read anybody or because I have been seduced by anybody else's way of thinking. I've been looking at this for years. We're seeing, I think we're seeing not a sudden collapse like the manufactured banking crises of 2008 and beyond, But we're seeing a gradual reconfiguration of the financial system from analog to digital. And this is being managed in a number of different ways. Perma crises in terms of international politics, wars in Ukraine and elsewhere, certainly. But also, I think what we're seeing is, so finance at the moment, you're going to argue with this, fair enough. Up to a point, it is decentralized, up to a point at the moment, right? Mostly, right? Because we have merchant banks, we have commercial banks, we obviously have cash, thank God, at the moment.
Well, and quite a few people have their own assets and wealth, which is what
they do. And you have, and market forces. So that's how it is now. But it's moving to, you said it earlier on yourself, to a centralized and programmable financial system, moving away from the individual choice of somebody like you, me, our partners, our friends, to kind of state-managed economic participation. That's where we're going. Do you know what they'll call it in years to come, long after we're dead? They'll call it the beginning of digital feudalism. That's where we're going now. I really believe this. I've never been more passionate about anything else. I've been looking at this for years. And do you know what I think is coming? And you're going to jump all over this. In about 3 or 4 or 5 years' time, maybe I'm talking bull, right? Maybe it'll be 5, 6 years' time. We're going to have a national emergency announcement, like we did in March of 2020, when Johnson addressed the nation and said, we're going to have to stay home for 3 weeks to flatten the curve. We know what happened after that. A prime minister in the future is going to address the nation and is going to say, we can no longer pay the bills. We can no longer pay the bills, right? They're going to say that debt interest, or paying down this debt interest, is consuming more of the budget than actual public services. They're going to say tax receipts are flatlined because of stagnation, they will say, because AI has taken up more and more and more jobs and more people are going to be out of work. People will resist. I believe there will be civil unrest. They will resist tax rises. The tax rises that will be announced because of what I've just said, because of stagnation and recession. And I think a future government will say this welfare state is financially unsustainable. We'll need radical reform. And I think, Tony, it'll be like the UK's Lehman Brothers moment. Not a bank collapse, but a societal economic collapse. They will announce it. They will say, this is it. We're going to have to move on to a new way of distributing and managing money. And that's when I think, I mean, we're seeing it already. NHS waiting lists, crumbling local services. We can't manage the court systems anymore. We've got to move to jury-less trials, legal system delays, council bankruptcies, Tony, which we've spoken about, you and me, on my show, like Birmingham. They will not be able to find the extra money. And that's when they will attempt to transfer us over to a completely digital financial system. I know it sounds awful. I know you like to look for something a bit positive, particularly on a Friday. But I can't see any way out of it, Tony. I really can't.
Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe war as well. I mean, this is one of those things.
Yeah.
I do wonder whether many of these things are there almost like a sort of behemoth in the corner to frighten us, or bogeyman, you know, and that fear is one of the big motivations out there. But look, we've also had, haven't we, the announcement that the French are now going to bring in a form of national service.
Voluntary,
military training. So it's not a kind of conscription thing. But do you know what? I think this is actually going to be popular in France because of the financial situation the way it is. For a lot of people, young people, they can't see much of a future. France, I think, is a bit better than the UK. But, you know, particularly with the student debt here, a lot of youngsters will be thinking, you know, if they were to do that in the UK, there'd be a lot of them are thinking, I'd much rather go and do a little bit of innocuous training in the army, so long as I'm not actually going to risk my life fighting Russia or something. And so it seems to me they've created the perfect conditions amongst young people, certainly here, likely in France too, where that they will embrace something like this. And it actually maybe even might do them good.
Maybe. Yeah, it's interesting that they've gone to great pains. You know, my you've met her, better half is French, so she's following this with great interest. It's been about 30 years since subscriptions, since National Military Service ended in France. I think you're right. It seems to be going down either well or either meh. You know, there doesn't seem to be any massive opposition to it in France, so long as it's voluntary. So the next question is that something that you think a Labour, maybe not a Labour government, but maybe the next government, maybe a Conservative government or a Conservative Reform coalition might think about introducing here?
Well, they've
it's
already
really
been
interesting.
Talking about it. To
they've
do
been talking
with,
about it, yeah.
Bringing it in to deal with the Russian threat, so-called threat.
Yeah, the phantom Russian threat. Makes me laugh, this idea that Russia, I mean, the constant talking about cyber warfare and hacking as if we're not doing it to every other country in the world as well. I mean, it must be just one big game among spooks. This is your area of expertise. You know far more about it than I do because you've researched several books on these subjects. But yeah, this holier-than-thou approach by UK politicians to what Russia might be doing, give me a break. Again, as if the UK doesn't have spies planted in Iran, in North Korea, in Russia and elsewhere, you know. I don't know what else to say.
I don't know if you've come across this story. I only came across it today. This guy, CJ Hopkins, he's, I think, an American based in Germany. He's come out with a lot of he's actually just, I think, been raided by the German police for apparently pro-Nazi views. Well, what he's doing, actually, he's saying is that the German government, by its aggression towards Russia and also by its COVID measures, is becoming very much like a Nazi regime. This is what he's been saying in this latest book of his. He was, I think, raided first because he put some information up on Twitter about it. So what he's saying is that the government now is a Nazi government, or it's becoming a Nazified government. It's a resurgence of the Nazis, which a lot of people would agree with. But I certainly would. If I'm looking at trying to rekindle World War II on the Eastern Front, which is what they appear to be doing, and these, you know, the very draconian lockdowns that most of the German citizens, you know, didn't really question too much. They just went along with it because that's what they like. And what he's pointing out is he's saying, well, actually, you're using this term Nazi all the time to describe Alternative for Deutschland, who, by the way, are a Farageist-type party over in Germany. And not only that, their candidates and their politicians are dying at a rate of knots. I think we're up to 11 now who have died in peculiar circumstances. It's difficult to know whether it's a natural death or not. It's generally the older ones that have been dying off. And I suppose Conservatives die too. But the Alternative for Deutschland is saying we're losing our people. We're not even sure why. So I wonder what you make of this. It almost as if what you've got is a very powerful superstate in Brussels that is it's like Brexit here. You know, everybody in Europe, the Frexit, you know, the yellow vests who wanted to get out of the EU, for example, they've had enough of it and they want their countries back as some sort of sovereign state. So when they're voting for their MPs, they're actually those are the people who are in charge, not Brussels anymore. So what do you make of this attitude in Germany to this guy's arrest?
It's really interesting. I didn't know about it until you told me about it. But you mentioned AfD, Alternative for Deutschland. I mean, we're seeing similar movements growing in Ireland. And then the national media will paint or attempt to paint these movements as far right or fascist. Look, again, going way back to when we first began speaking, I haven't changed my mind on this, and I will if I ever see anything to convince me that I'm wrong. But immigration and the mass movement of people is one of the elite's great tools, Tony, isn't it? I mean, it is really. I mean, what we've seen in Germany is undoubtedly the response to Merkel's decision to allow 1 million people into the country. And I think for decades, they've used immigration to divide people, to stoke unrest, but also to distract people from what's really going on. I mean, if I'm right, and I might not be right, this digital feudal system that I think is coming down the track some would call it a technocracy. This is a wonderful distraction for it. All of these issues around Nazism and fascism and migrant flows. I mean, we're seeing it here in the UK. I don't have to tell you, but the media here, if you leave the BBC to one side, really, but even LBC, GB News, Talk TV, most of its editorial is taken up with issues to do with migration, isn't it? You'd agree with that. So it's never ending, really. So I see this as being just one great, great distraction. And it's something that is happening in lockstep, I think, Tony. Like I've already said, Ireland, but we know there are issues in Scandinavia. We know there are issues in other parts of Europe. And it saddens me, really, because conservatives who seemingly used to understand this, used to understand that the mass movement of people was a divide and conquer strategy. They seem to have forgotten it, Tony. I don't know what you think about that. They've forgotten the reason for it. And they've just gotten, they've thrown themselves headfirst into relentless social media wars about migration, a lot of which has a real tinge of xenophobia attached to it, I think.
Well, I mean, but it's also, what it's done is it's happening on such a scale that it's undermining national identity, national culture.
Yeah.
And also, of course, it's massively undercutting wages. So it seems to me like the whole thing, I think it started, the small boats thing started when there was a seaman's strike. I don't know when that was, must be 2015 or something.
Yeah.
And then it all started, but it seems to me, yeah, it was around about the time of Brexit. So this is a sort of the European elite, I think, the mass that runs Europe, saying, well, look, you know, never mind your Brexit, mate. We're going to be bringing in all these people anyway.
And here's the tragedy. Here's the tragedy. And I know I'm only repeating myself. People who used or who seemed to understand this are now back to full-on migrant blaming. I wouldn't dream of gaslighting people. Of course there have been problems with some young men who might have a very conservative view of, a conservative reading of their own religion, maybe. But nowhere near on the scale that some people are alleging. You know, this idea that migrants are rapists and all of this nonsense. And that really, really upsets me.
And also, what annoys me more than anything else, this is us both having a bit of a rant together about this and venting our spleen, is the way that the subject of so much of this is the migrants themselves. Nobody can blame them for wanting a better life. It's the mafias, mainly the Brussels-based and German mafias, that are bringing these people in to the country. Those are the people, but of course they're invisible, so you can't go and really kind of criticise them too much. But look, I want to also bring in a topic which I found absolutely weird and fascinating, which was this parade in Liverpool after the football victory, and the guy has just suddenly switched his plea from not guilty to guilty on all charges. Now, I watched the footage of that very closely when it happened, and all the various things being uploaded to social media, and you can piece together, if you take the time, what happened. He came round a corner in his car. He realised, you know, oh dear, I'm in the middle of a massive rally here and surrounded by drunk people. And he wasn't really sure what to do. He started to reverse. There were already people behind him. Whatever he did, it probably would have been better for him to just get out of the car and join the party. But what happened is there were some yobbos around him who were obviously drunk and started shouting at him. When he ran the window down and shouted back, they started kicking the car. They were really attacking him. They smashed the back window of the car. And of course, he's an army trained person, ex Royal Marine. He's reacting as if he's under attack. And so he went forward. He didn't kill anybody, but he was, to me, what should have happened there is the people who attacked his car should have been in the dock. But no, that didn't happen, because most of them that on the film that I saw were ethnic minorities. That may have played a part in all of this. And also, of course, he switching his plea at the last minute is almost certainly some kind of plea bargain. They said to you, right, well, we can cut your sentence down if you plead not guilty.
Yeah, it's very interesting, this. I like everybody else, paid a lot of attention to it at the time. Very interesting and surprising somewhat that the guy has just copped to it and he'll be sentenced now in a couple of weeks' time. He'll get a lot of time in prison, I would imagine. They say, though, the Crown says that the dash cam footage that they were able to obtain from his camera that was mounted on the inside of his car shows that they say he became agitated by the crowds and basically lost his temper and drove at them in a complete loss of control, and that his claim, because apparently he claimed after he was arrested that somebody came at him with a knife, they say that couldn't be substantiated at all. But I'm kind of with you. The footage that is available to us shows before this guy drove erratically into people, showed his car being pushed and kicked and then smashed up. So, yeah, it's a really strange one, this.
Yeah, and if you're in the NX Army and someone smashes the back window of your car, they're kicking it, you open the door and someone kicks it. Listen, man. Anyway, so I just think this is...
An obvious
sort of, kind of miscarriage of justice. Maybe they should have brought some other people in.
Maybe he should have better representation, maybe. Yeah. Maybe his representation is all wrong.
Well, listen, you try and find an honest lawyer. That's not an easy ask, is it?
No, and I wonder, I don't know if you know this. Has he paid for his own barrister or is it legal aid? That would interest me to know.
He's got his own lawyers, I would imagine. But even they get got at. Lawyers make a lot of money through bribes and that sort of... They wouldn't call them bribes. Unofficial conversations with the other side in the case, this sort of thing. We've also heard this idea of getting rid of juries. My God, this is David Lammy, who's a Bilderberger. He's obviously on the road to stardom, and this seems to be his pièce de résistance to get rid of, basically tear up Magna Carta, Richie.
And who do you think told him to do that, Tony? You see, David Lammy couldn't add two and two together without counting on his fingers. In my opinion, David Lammy is as dumb a politician as has ever held a ministerial role in any government. I couldn't care less if people listening to this, if they start thinking racism or xenophobia, his skin colour's got nothing to do with it. Lammy is as thick as pig manure. He is as dumb as anything. Are we to believe that David Lammy dreamt up this idea of removing juries from pretty much all trials apart from murder and very violent offences? No, it's coming from elsewhere, Tony. And you hinted at it yourself with Bilderberg. Am I right in saying this idea originated in Scotland a couple of years ago, the Scottish Union for Education? Well, look, they're pretty smart people.
I'm not sure, but certainly...
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
There is a...
It's madness.
It's
authoritarian.
The country is being run by other than people. So, I mean, I think we've basically got a fascist system. That is to say, it's a mixture of that and socialism, I suppose, to a certain extent through government. But it's private interests, private businesses which are running things. And also, we really ought to, before we close, mention the BBC, because I as an ex-reporter journalist there myself, I look at what's been happening to it as... playing into the hands of Rupert Murdoch. These private businesses, I look at the Daily Mail and particularly at the Murdoch empire, which is spreading still into books and everything, of course, they're taking over cross-media ownership, as so pro-Israel as to be off the scale. The BBC is, biased. Yeah, sure. And it's so they've had to put dodgy people in charge of it, who are there not to run the BBC, but to sabotage it for people like Murdoch.
Yeah, absolutely right, yeah. And look, you knew once the BBC bosses were hauled before MPs, you knew they wouldn't make any sort of real robust defence of what it is the BBC purports to do. To label the BBC as pro-Palestinian, you and I speak a lot about Israel. On the genocide in Gaza, I actually, as a journalist, if I leave my own pro-Palestinian feelings to one side, and I can do that, I'm mature enough to do that, as a journalist, I look at the BBC and I applaud the BBC for what it's done, because it has gone further than any other organisation in reporting on the genocide. But to the credit of the BBC, it has bookended those reports constantly with... Chippy Hotavelli appearing or some murderous commander from the IDF The BBC has got its Israel coverage absolutely spot on in the last 3 years, in my opinion.
Not too bad, because in the,
not know, too bad.
All of,
nothing
all
to apologise
the bad
for.
Things like cancelling this documentary, etc., were all interventions from the top. Anyway, look, we've haven't got any more time, Richie, I'm afraid. We've got to run out of time. So can you please, in 30 seconds, just let listeners know where to find and follow you?
The best thing to do is go to my website, richieallen.co.uk. I'm on Twitter as BBGRichie. And please God, I'll be back broadcasting live Monday to Thursday from next week, where you will fairly often hear your very own Tony Gosling. Thanks for the opportunity today, pal. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, one of the few little spaces you'll find out there amongst the controlled opposition.
Thanks, T.
All right. Cheers, Richie.
Well, thanks, Richie. I really appreciate you giving up your time to talk to us. And also, isn't it important that he gets the tab, his say? It annoys me, you know, that things like that happen. Who knows? Maybe it was hacked. He says no. He may well be right. Maybe he kicked it by accident. But anyway, bless him. Nice one, Richie. Thanks ever so much for your time, taking us through all those subjects, including David Lammy. Oh, God. The head of he's a justice secretary. It's like an obvious. Who's told him to do this? The Bilderbergers. Well, worth mentioning, of course, the connection with the Bilderbergs and the Freemasons, which some people sometimes forget. Lammy is very much a Bilderberger. He's the guy who, a couple of years ago, when we were covering the Lisbon conference, we saw him dash. They wouldn't let him in. They didn't know who he was, and he had to get on his phone. He was on his phone. Anyway, we were taking pictures of him on his phone, trying to persuade them to let him in. And he had to actually run away and hide behind a bush for a little while on his phone. Giorgio, I think he's an Italian guy that lives in Brussels. He was there, and he got some great photos and had a little chat with David Lammy and coaxed him out from behind the bush. And eventually he was let into the Bilderberg conference. But he's a wannabe, you know. I want to be with people like Mark Carney and Peter Thiel. They're such the powerful people. I want to be like them. Yeah, great guy to have as a Justice Secretary, isn't it? Anyway, look, on to the real important stuff from the budget. And the budget, of course, affects the farmers very much, particularly with this. I mean, it really is a horrendous situation because many of them are hardly turning a profit. And if this inheritance tax is supposed to kick in next April, it means that they will not be able to hand their farms on to their kids, that the farms part of them will have to be sold, and then it's going to be even less viable. And certainly not their grandchildren. It's a really terrible thing to have done, to attack them. Of course, this is a way of freeing up land so big companies like BlackRock can come along and buy it up, or other companies that do carbon offset can turn up and plant trees everywhere. No, we want the land to be used to grow food by our fellow Brits, that is to say the family farmers.
What are we doing here today? We've come up to London today, obviously Budget Day, to show our dismay at the government. What could possibly go on in the budget for not only farmers but for everybody, and with the ongoing inheritance tax issues. We didn't find out. We travelled up late last night and got into London about 1:30 this morning and didn't know anything about it till we were stopped by police officers and said the demonstration isn't going ahead. You're not permitted to park your tractors in London. Then proceeded to give us some paperwork and show us on a map where we couldn't park. But as I say, luckily enough, we managed to get parked up off the road and we stayed in our tractors all night. But why it's been cancelled, I do not know. I can only presume that there's going to be some ultra bad news in the budget this afternoon, and the powers that be in the city didn't want hordes of farmers with heavy machinery in the city. I farm in Andover in Hampshire. We're about 600 acres and I'm a mixed farm, so I produce store cattle and I produce arable crops. Not me, because I'll be in a box, but my two children, the day when I die, hopefully I've got a few more years left in me yet, and a rough bag paper sums will be $1 million, $1.5 million, and we just don't earn the money out of it. And my children will have to pay a vast amount of money to buy their own farm back. So we are down by the Tate Gallery. I can't remember the name of the road down there. But we managed to park off the road outside the Tate Gallery at about 1:30 this morning. We had interactions with the police that informed us that the demonstration had been cancelled today. Wouldn't advise us as to where else we could park up because they weren't allowed to. So as I say, we got off the road and we slept in the tractors all night. as we've been stood here. Yes, we've been warned as we're talking to people and members of the public, we've been warned that if we don't move on, we may possibly be arrested. And Red Tractor is another thing that is getting outdated, you know. You can go into a shop and buy something that's Red Tractor assured, a piece of meat. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's produced or grown in England, as long as it's been packed in a Red Tractor assured production line. They can put that sticker on there, but the meat might be from somewhere around the world that's got substandard practices to ours, and it's just not a level playing field that we can compete with.
So my name's Mark Wattler. I work on a big arable farm in the Vale of Beaver in Leicestershire. I've been working on farms since the age of 12, and it's all I've ever wanted to do. It's just soul destroying at the moment. We want to be listened to. We want to produce the best quality food in this world. We want to feed this country. We want British people to buy British food that's traceable. We know where it's come from. We know what inputs have gone into it, what chemicals have gone into it. And it's all about traceability. And we need to support our British farmers and pay them a fair price for their food. Because at the moment, we're getting paid the same prices as we were 2 years ago, but our import costs have doubled. So it's just... we just want to be listened to. The inheritance tax, yes, it's a massive thing. That's what the media picks up on all the time. And, yeah, we would like them to review that and raise the thresholds so it doesn't impact so many family farms that just want to farm and want to pass those farms on to their kids and their grandkids. This demonstration was started organising 6 weeks ago. And we got permission from the Met Police to park on Whitehall like we did last time when we had to visit London before, and have a peaceful demonstration, a show of numbers, and just tell the government that we haven't gone away. But yesterday afternoon at about 3 o'clock, the organisers got told by the Met Police that we're not allowed to bring any agricultural vehicles, tractors, etc. into London. We're allowed to have a peaceful foot protest. They've given us a little patch of land down the road here to have a peaceful protest, which we plan to do anyway, but the police have just overreacted, unfortunately. You know, a lot of people have just come down and brought their tractors anyway, because we've got a right to protest. We were here peacefully parked up on just down from Trafalgar Square, and then the police, I think, put a section 50 notice or something like that on us to disperse. And they've brought in a firm with a wrecker and a low loader to forcibly evict us if we needed to. I think they've already arrested a couple of tractor drivers. Some of them have been de-arrested. But, yeah, they've basically just put a dispersion notice on us where we were congregating up at Trafalgar Square. So they've got a little bit heavy-handed with it. And all we're trying to do is our legal right to protest, which they've known about for 6 weeks. You know, this was a planned, working with them, demonstration. And they're the ones that have caused all the congestion today by stopping us legally protesting.
Yeah, hi there. Tom Edwards. This is my daughter, Beth. I've got a son at home, Will. We're just hoping to pass all our 5 years of work, five generations of work, to my next generation, Beth. The way the government have done it with this inheritance tax, it's just not going to happen. We're just going to have to find... it's going to be like £100,000 a year to pay off this stupid tax idea. We're £200,000 in the debt already. Like, how do we come up with this sort of money? Like, they haven't got a clue. We're just, you know, working 7 days a week to put food on the table for people, and they just don't realise, you know, the effort is involved. Like, it's, I don't know, I've been quite upset about it, really, to be honest. What why can't they just come to the table and have a talk with us? There's options out there that would sort this out. You know, I'm in favour of tax. We pay our taxes. If we earn money, we pay a fair tax. The public don't think we pay any tax, but we've got a tractor at home. It's costing us £2,500 a month just to have a tractor. We don't own it. We just lease it in like everyone else with a car. Like I said, if we
earn money, then we pay off our taxes. This new tax IC thing is just going to kill us. I can't. The only way I can pay that tax is to sell land, and that, as I said, you know, four generations to build up a business that's sustainable. If we sell land off, then it's not going to be sustainable, so you'll have to work somewhere else. Like I said, my message to the government is stock up on bread and cheese. It's going to be a long winter.
So my name is Montgomery Toms, and I've been fighting kind of against authoritarian regimes and attacks on the British public since I was about 14 when the lockdowns hit, because I felt that that was a really hostile and illogical and immoral and unscientific attack on young people and all generations as well. And that has expanded quite immensely into evaluating the previous government and the current government when it comes to their, as I say, illogical and immoral and completely awful approaches to the people and the public. And inheritance tax is an attack on the farmers, but it's also an attack on the people and the public. Because if you attack the farmers, the heart of our country, the backbone of Britain, the people that are responsible for putting food on our plates, then you're also attacking the British people. And that's why we've got to come together in entirety. It's not just about saying, oh, well, farmers are not professional activists out here. They've got to work, and they want to work. They don't want to be out here, but they feel like they have to. So that's why I actually say that it's actually more of a responsibility of the British public and the people to come out on the street, to top up work and grassroots work, to stand and fight for our farmers. And it's not just that. You know, I also expand on things looking at digital IDs and free speech and the fact that we have today a demonstration that has been disrupted by the Metropolitan Police as of yesterday, turning around and saying, oh, well, you can't bring your tractors in here, even though this happened last year. And the reason that is because it's terrifying. And when you see that also almost militant array last year around the tractors taking up Whitehall, you realise how much power there is in grassroots work and how much power there is within the British public and the farmers. And that terrifies them. And as I just mentioned earlier, Rachel Thieves in her announcement, I mean, it was just laughable. But what was most intriguing is she went into quite a lot of depth on some of the topics. When it comes to the farmers, it's let's brush that under the carpet. And that's why I think that they don't want this to be investigated, because there could well be, I would say there is, but I'm happy to be contested on it, a sinister ulterior motive to have the likes of kind of BlackRock and Net Zero Protocols and Mad Ed Miliband buying up land. And, well, not Ed Miliband, but BlackRock, and sticking solar panels all over them and bringing forward this mental net zero fantasy, and also take decentralized environments and communities and centralize them and instill this relentless need for top-down authoritarian control in this country. And we're seeing it with the farmers, we're seeing it with the public, we're seeing it within education, private institutions, everywhere. There's constant need to control us. And inheritance tax, yeah, it is linked.
That was from Farms Not Factories, who we heard from last week. You know, they were accused by the Daily Mail of being anti-Semitic. Remember that? That's Farms Not Factories report there. And you can find them up on YouTube. No, hang on. I think it's actually the Facebook page. They uploaded those actually on Wednesday, just after the budget was being, or as the budget was being read out. So they're great. They're always in there doing their stuff. Thank you very much to Alistair and to Tracy at Farms Not Factories for producing those reports so snappily, very well watched around the UK. The stuff that the mainstream media wasn't covering, was it? They weren't really looking at the farmers, though, were they? They were looking everywhere else. So what do we do about all this? Let's have a listen to a guy called Steve Keane. This is annoying. It's because it's not on British television. It's been blocked. It's been banned by Ofcom. But we also go to the Bilderberg conferences. This is on Going Underground, which is on RT. I think it's Dubai that Afshin Ratanzi does this weekly programme from. It may even be couple of times a week, but he produces some brilliant stuff, these long form interviews with really, really interesting people. Potentially, maybe next week we'll have another excerpt from Going Underground with this lady from the CIA who was involved in the killing of Soleimani. But here's Going Underground. This is Steve Keane, the economist, one of the greatest in the world, someone that's been a friend to this programme over the years, from Guildford University. He's out abroad somewhere now, I believe. But anyway, here is why BRICS must replace the United States. authoritarian international financial system, with Professor Steve Keen on Afshin Ratansi's Going Underground this week.
I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, which voted this week, like most of the rest of the world, to combat the glorification of Nazism, neo-Nazism and other practices that contribute to fueling contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia and related intolerance. NATO nation leaders voted against combating Nazism as they armed this week's indiscriminate attacks on Gaza, Syria and Lebanon. Yet some of them will still be permitted today at one of the biggest global events of the year, the G20 summit. This year, it's in South Africa on the world's poorest continent. But with no shows from the leaders of the world's largest economies, the USA's Trump, China's Xi, nor Russia's Putin, is the summit symbolic of an earthquake in the global economic order? With global inequality soaring, the richest 10% of people now account for 74% of the world's wealth, according to the G20. Contributing factors include the IMF World Bank debt burden and NATO's forever wars. Someone who foresaw the Western economic crisis is honorary professor at University College London, Steve Keen, author of The New Economics, a manifesto. He joins me from Amsterdam in Holland. Steve, welcome back to Going Underground. Obviously, Trump probably not going to the G20 because of... I don't know, Jeffrey Epstein, wars on Venezuela, wars on Iran, who knows?
Couldn't possibly be the reason.
What do you think significance is of them not turning up, the big powers, the largest economies?
Yeah, in some ways the G20 is sliding into being a failed sideshow. All these things seem to follow this trajectory because they never solve the problems they come together to supposedly address, and after a while it becomes an embarrassment.
Of course, Steve, at all these sorts of big international conferences, there are all these NGOs, different organizations, and many of them, I presume, will be telling these G20 leaders that the current path of capitalism is going quite smoothly. Why do you think that the role of private debt, if anything, will be celebrated amongst these people as they advise world leaders from the G20 countries, rather than, as you would say, something to be incredibly worried about? Many of these people presumably have shares in, apart from U.S. Treasuries, they'll have shares maybe in the big seven on Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems about our private debt situation, of course, it's a problem for the relatively poor rather than the relatively obscenely rich, because what you get is the high level of private debt is what's causing economic stagnation over time. Private debt is what really weighs on people's desires to invest, people's desires to buy houses and so on. So we're living with a high level of private debt than even during the Great Depression, and that's a major reason why demand is anemic, basically relying upon government spending. And of course, the people who benefit from this are the ultra wealthy who own the shares in the banks, and they're profiting out of that, the burden that's falling upon the bottom 80% of the population. And at the same time, these governments are all trying to reduce government debt, and that actually puts a further burden on the private sector. So ironically, what they think is making the economies work better, reducing government debt, actually makes the economy work less well and forces people into speculative bubbles like Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, crypto is another issue, of course. But ironically, I mean, at least you think that Trump sees, unlike other administrations, that economic policies should be tailored to those regions or countries, I mean, when he's not going to war with them, which is another element, because clearly Keynesian military spending is the big talk in Western Europe and the United States. Why don't we just talk about that? There's a solution: war, the mass murder of men, women, and children. I mean, Britain the other day talking about new arms factories. All across Western Europe, the talk is of that, and the big beautiful bill massively subsidized the big five arms companies in the United States. Won't that solve the private debt problem that you worry about?
Oh, this is the hilarious.
If we put morality to one side.
They all They all believe they can have a wall-led economy revival in the same way they believe they can have a foreign investment-led revival. And I amusingly went to the Web Summit last week in Portugal, and that's a huge conference, 80,000 people, all about the impact of the web on economic activity, of course. And there would have been 80, I guess, countries inside there, all trying to take foreign investment away from each other. Now, of course, the net sum of all that is zero. Because if one company invests in your country rather than its host country, then it's going to have less investment, not more, unless it takes on more private debt. So all these things end to be effectively zero-sum games. And I can't think of a greater zero-sum game than believing you can have a wall-led recovery.
And as journalists cover breathlessly the change in interest rate, from a central bank, you think none of them understand that it is a zero-sum game?
They don't seem to. And you get journalists reporting on the latest machinations of Reeves and Starmer, for example, and it's all about trying to attract foreign investment. That's in Britain. Where do they get it from? If you go to the conference like this, there's the UK trying to get it. There's Malta. The number of countries I saw was hilarious. Fundamentally, because they're all trying to do the same thing. They say we can't generate the investment spending in our own country, so let's try to take it from somebody else's. What they don't realize, and this is what it's so frustrating for me to watch, is that governments can create as much money as they feel willing to do, then they're not going into debt when they sell bonds in their own currency. So they're all kind of cut back on the one thing which they can do without taking spending away from each other. But at the same time, they're all trying to make more money by taking foreign investment away from each other and by bombing the hell out of each other. So what you see them doing, the one thing which they could actually do without treading on each other's toes is run a larger government deficits, because there's no way in which one government deficit causes another country to be either in deficit or surplus. They are independent. But foreign investment is taking money from one country to another. The war again. How do you increase economic activity for the planet by blowing parts of it up? There are elements that they're thinking which are so short-sighted. It's just ludicrous to think that these are our leaders.
Yeah, but if you put aside the short-term thinking and realize that obviously democracies in Western Europe and many of the G20 countries work on a 5-year cycle or 4-year cycle. Can you not see why they will focus on massive government spending on the war, the proxy war in Russia through Ukraine? I mean, what have you made of how, I mean, if you ignore the hundreds of thousands of killed Ukrainian men, young men, do these financiers and finance ministers in G20 countries see it as a net positive that they have been killed?
In the circles in which they move, they would see it as a net positive, because, of course, if governments are creating money to fight wars elsewhere in the world, then that is a net increase in total spending. And then the military companies, the weapons manufacturers, make a fortune out of that. And those are the circles in which politicians move. They basically listen to bankers and warmongers. And between the two, it means that they end up ignoring private debt and encouraging government money to be used to sponsor military campaigns. And it's, there's one of the classic cases where the mass of the population lose out, and some of them lose their lives as well, out of what the elite sees as a way of increasing its wealth and power.
And this year's G20 being on the continent of Africa makes one immediately think of the influence of the IMF and the World Bank and their policies over decades on that continent. How would you characterize them?
Yeah, they're destructive. I mean, I've literally had World Bank staff come to see me after they've retired and show me the spreadsheets that they take to these countries, and the entire process is trying to make sure the spreadsheet balances according to the principles of the IMF. That involves slashing government spending programs on the poor. So the IMF is actually contributing to the inequality that exists, and it's already the major destabilizing force in human society at the moment. And the naive neoclassical economic analysis that all these economists who work for the World Bank and the IMF have ends up amplifying the inequality caused by the market system itself. When they retire, they often end up being, they end up apologizing and confessing what they've done. They can finally see the damage they've done. But when they're employed, it seems to be the pressure of work. They just go ahead and they end up slashing government programs for the poor while they're in power and regretting it later on. Well, I think they should regret it while they're in power and do something about it.
Professor Steve Keane. Well, there you go. This is the guy that should be Chancellor. Give him a job. He's brilliant. But you don't want to do that, do you? Because you're a little cult and you'd like to keep the people who are going to look after the public out of the way, because you hate the public. You're afraid of the public, aren't you? On the budget, thank you very much, Patricia. Black Rot is her poem this week. Budget week, on high alert, leaks and spats and dishing dirt, cutbacks, attacks, hit where it hurts, while cap in hand, the poor overt. Black Rot budget, no ends to meet, they live it large on Champagne Street. Blurred lines of wealth, revolving doors, billions and trillions, yet still want more. Vast wealth from wars to peace see sway, big pharma, drug cartel in swathes. While shaping raping industries, Black Rock boss world policies. Rap, trap, the music industry, a Hollyweird of crime we see, cultural weaponizing wars of media, another whore. Black Rock, our world now, vis-a-vis, join the dots, it's plain to see, global wealth, nay, invisible, but of who? Who's who, pray tell? Thanks, Patricia. Larry Fink is the guy. World Economic Forum is his game.
Another one this week, final piece before the break. We're going to hear from a chap called John Hamer. He's another one of these people who's always being accused of anti-Semitism. And I looked through his stuff. I didn't see the anti-Semitic stuff in there at all. So you do the same. You know, don't trust me. Go and have a look. He does regular bits and pieces. I think it's called The Falsification of History, one of his well-known books. And he gets around the place, does a super job. Here he is speaking about the child murders in Cambridgeshire from 2002. And like me, he believes that it may be a connection to the United States Air Force base at Lake and Heath in these murders, and that potentially Ian Huntley, who's supposed to have carried out these murders, didn't do it. So this could be a massive miscarriage of justice. It'd be nice to have Joan Bakewell or whoever it was that used to do rough justice on the television, but we don't have any programmes like that anymore, do we? So what we have got is the Soham child murders in Cambridgeshire, England, with also John Hamer. And here he is on one of these. I'm not sure what podcast it is. I'll put a link up to it anyway.
The whole premise of my investigation, of my, shall we say, belief in what happened, is something that some people might think is fairly off the wall. But I believe what happened, they were just handily placed at that time, and the police didn't really want to go to the places where they ought to have been going in order to properly invest the crime, because of the political situation at that time in the UK. Do you want me to explain that a little bit more?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely.
Right, okay. Well, if the listeners cast their minds back to August 2002, they might recall that it was about 6 months before the invasion of Iraq, with US and Britain, British forces invading Iraq. And at that time, obviously the British public and even the American public weren't aware that that was going to happen. But obviously that was in the pipeline politically. And Tony Blair and George Bush had already been colluding about a joint operation to move into Iraq later that year. Well, in fact, in the following spring. And the last thing that Blair and his government needed was any kind of public opinion that was going to, shall we say, put American service people stationed in Britain in a very bad light. And it's significant that the village of Soham is about 10 miles from a massive USAF base called USAF Lake and Heath, which housed about 10,000 American servicemen. Some of them were stationed there permanently, and some were, it was used as a transit a stopover, if you like, from troops going back and to from Afghanistan to the States. Obviously, it was a long hop. So they used to stop over at Lakenheath a lot of the time. Sometimes they did that in Germany, but sometimes it was Lakenheath. So there's a massive amount of American servicemen moving in and out of that camp at all times. But the point, sorry, I've gone off the point a little bit there, but the point of it is the fact that Blair could not risk actually investigating as to whether it could have possibly been an American serviceman that had done this dirty deed, because he didn't want to turn public opinion against the US or its servicemen in any way because of what was about, what was in the pipeline and what was about to happen.
They
knew
that it was going to happen. Gotcha. Yeah. And, wow. So, all these things were happening. And, but the other thing is that what we'll find out later is that the girls were found close to Lakenheath, correct?
They were found in a ditch on the perimeter fence of Lakenheath Air Base, yeah. I mean, the other thing was, why on earth would anybody in their right minds drive 10 miles and dump a body somewhere where they were bound to be seen, because there were so many comings and goings of different people? You know, it was such a busy spot. I mean, no one in their right minds would drive from Soham to Lakenheath and dump it at the perimeter fence of a huge air base where there was so much activity going on all the time.
And monitoring, I mean, right? They monitor the perimeter. So.
Well, exactly. I mean, and what had happened was, in the previous few weeks, as the build-up to Iraq, although it was still secret, was going on, they were increasing all the security at all the bases. So they had this state-of-the-art security system put in. And importantly, I think this is very significant, actually, that it's known that the camera positions were changed daily, and also there were the sweep of the cameras as to where they actually panned around, that was also changed. The angles were changed all the time. So that there was a constant changing of so that, you know, even if there might have been blind spots here and there, you had to know exactly where those cameras were pointing and what their arc of sweep was to actually escape them. Now, Huntley wouldn't have had a clue about that, whereas an American serviceman might have. I'm not saying definitely would have, but might have. It's certainly been a better position than Huntley to understand exactly where the cameras lie and where their points of view were.
That's author John Hamer there, talking about back in 2019, talking about the 2002 Soham child murders. That's the first time I come across. He's done a good job, I think, in pulling apart some of the key facts that make you think, well, this isn't right, is it? Something very strange going on there. So anyway, we'll be back after the break to have a little look at Ukraine, and also to hear a bit from this woman, Susan Miller. We'll be hearing more from him hopefully next week about Operation Gladio, and looking also, of course, at the German arrests of people that say that their government is behaving like the Nazis.
so warm. Tucked in mathematics, I could have been a dawn. I could program a computer, choose the perfect time. If you've got the inclination, I have got the crime.
You've got to find a way to say what you want to say. Break out.
copy. Your coach made a mess of the copy. He loves Keith Boxley Barnsley. He loves Keith Boxley Barnsley. He's an A-born representative. He's an A-born representative. Hello, John, what are you about? Ah! 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 Hello, John, got a new mouth, ah! Hello, John, got a new mouth, ah! They put me in a special hospital. They put me in a special hospital. Is there life on Mars? Is there life on Mars? Is there life in Peckham? Is there life in Peckham? What's that switch over there for? What's that switch over there for? Hello, John, got a new mouth, ah! Hello, John, got a new mouth, ah! He can't half play the bongos. He can't half play the bongos. He's got a record by Billy Joel. He's got a record by Billy Joel. Them locks are easy. Them locks are easy. Here's my calling card. What? Here's my calling card. What? That's a piece of balsa. That's a piece of balsa. You can make a model out of that. You can make a model out of that. He stuck his head in a dustbin. He stuck his head in a dustbin. And ran through the laundry. Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! Here, John, do you like the suit, dear, eh? Hey, it's a lovely suit, you know. Want a brown ale? Yeah, want a brown ale? Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! Mind your light and bitter! Mind your light and bitter! Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! He works on the Thames barrier! He works on the Thames barrier! I keep tropical fish! I keep tropical fish! In me underpants, in me underpants. Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! He walks around with an hat on, he walks around with an hat on.
Oh, yeah, he's the intelligent one. He's in the police force. Yeah.
Hello, John, got your mouth, ah! Hello, John, got your mouth, ah!
Been to Miami? Lovely, Miami. Package store in Miami. It can't get a lot better. Can't get a lot better in Miami. You can get one in Bermondsey, though. That's a nice sound as well, Bermondsey. You can get a light and bitter, and it sounds nice. Light and bitter, that sounds nice. I'd like a light and bitter. Ah, oh, cheers, thanks a lot. Oh, nice one, yeah. All right, what are you having? What are you having, eh? Pina colada. Lovely. Hey, you must be sophisticated.
Hello, hello, John Cosimo, ah! Hello, John Cosimo, ah! You coach made a mess of the coffee. You coach made a mess of the coffee.
Hello, John, got me more dark.
Yeah, that's a nice two-piece suite.
Yeah.
I like your music, Senator. Here, got any Demis Roussos? Oh, I like him. Barry Manilow. Oh, I think he's terrific. Oh, I love him. I love Barry Manilow. I love him all week. When I hear Barry Manilow, I love him all week.
Just a girl who only wants
So that was I Heard the Voice of Jesus, the beginning there, lovely little hymn. Then we heard from the Pet Shop Boys, Let's Make Lots of Money. That's another title for that, I think, remember from back in the day. But that's the one we know it as. 1986, that was. And then we had a I did a sort of slightly weird thing, didn't I? Because we played this a few weeks ago, this song Breakout by Swing Out Sister. But it is a particularly brilliant song. And do you know what? It's got exactly the same intro. Maybe it's the Polydor, the same record company, the same producer or something, as the Pet Shop Boys' other song, which is West End Girls, isn't it? Ooh, a bit weird. Maybe I should play both of those together sometime if I really want to try and do your heads in. But anyway, Alexis Sale after that with Hello, John Got On Your Motor from 1984, a couple of years before Swing Out Sister and the Pet Shop Boys there. And then finally, St Etienne. Who Do You Think You Are? What a fantastic little bunch they were. I think there's a CD of their singles out somewhere, which is full of absolutely brilliant. One of my favourites from them was called The Railway Jam. Now, okay, so I'm a bit of a railway nerd, I suppose. I don't know much about it, but I love old railways. I've written an article all about beaching and about railways, how they petrodollar forced them out, and the policy was to go start building loads of cars, to use loads of oil. The Americans didn't want us extracting oil from the North Sea and bringing the world oil price down. So the quid pro quo was they would allow us to extract North Sea oil, but only if we opened up a UK domestic market for petrol. That was in the late 50s, but mainly the early 1960s. And then we had this thing called the Beeching Report, 1963, which closed down most of the British rail network. And now, of course, it's all been privatised. If you want to see, I'm a radio railway jam, a St Etienne nerd. What we've got now, we've had this various times, we've been talking about this, is we've got the Roscoes. These are the rolling stock companies. These are the ones that are really extracting massive amounts of profits from the railway. So you're paying nothing like what it's actually costing you to get around. The train operating companies are fairly marginal in their profitability, but it's the Roscoes, the ones that actually own the rolling stock and lease it out to the train operating companies. They're creaming it off big time. So that's another way that we're paying more for our railways. Sorry, this is my little bugbear, is the overhead lines. These cost loads to maintain and they cost a fortune to install. Don't just get rid of the overhead lines. Just run a diesel or a steam, dare I say it. A diesel is obviously the easiest way to get around on the train. And why don't we just have diesel engines? No problem. Just run them on a track. You don't need all this overhead. And it's the maintenance contracts, and but not so much the construction, the maintenance contracts on these overhead lines. And of course, when you get weird weather, whether it's windy, freezing cold, or extremely hot, there are all sorts of problems with these overhead electric lines. So, I've got to cancel all the train. No. Yeah, anyway, so that's my little rant about St Etienne's Railway Jam. Maybe we'll play that another week sometime. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with no Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, but you do have me, Tony Gosling, you lucky folks. And I will be taking you now we're going to go plunging straight in through the firewall to listen to RT. This week they had a brilliant piece I thought was fantastic, and this is just an extract from it, but gives you a taster. There's loads going on in Ukraine at the moment. We've got all this fuss-potting going on with maybe the European leaders all going over to see Donald Trump again to try and persuade him not to stop their lovely little war they're having. And so the lineup for this show, I just thought, wow, these producers at RT, if I was producing, this is exactly the sort of lineup that I would have. That is to say, you've got Peter Lavelle in the chair on Crosstalk. You've then got Patrick Henningsen. Matthew Eret from Montreal, I think he's from. He's from this Canadian program, which I think he's on a little bit later with Cynthia Chung as well. Great, very, very good, smart guy, as well as Alex Craner. So no controlled opposition, I do believe, in this program at all, looking at Trump's attempt to finish the Ukraine war and get a peace deal.
People are so desperate, Peter, for a solution to bring this war to an end. I mean, many people want this. Well, we want it. The people want it. Maybe not the European leadership. So they've created a thirst trap. And Trump is the master at feeding the thirst trap. He is the absolute maestro in terms of controlling the media cycle. And what he's done here is floated this out, much like Anchorage and much like previous efforts before, floated this out into the public. Then it gets devoured and then like digested by committee from different people in different corners. And he wins because he's leading the news cycle. Everyone's reacting to him. They're coming to him. He likes that. But the problem is this type of method of, quote, deal making is completely incompatible with international relations, completely incompatible with diplomacy. It will not work in the end. It always fails. And the reason it fails is because this isn't how you come to any kind of multilateral agreement. This is complicated enough between the United States, Moscow, the various and sundry European leaders, plus Kiev as well. It's complicated enough. And the way his method of doing this, it might be great for what he believes is important, which is the optics, which is the big splash. And there's also a little bit of U.S. domestic politics baked in here as well. This has provided a huge distraction from some big problems domestically in the U.S. But at the end of the and at the end of the day, it's bailed out Zelensky in Ukraine because they're looking for a strategic pause because they're getting absolutely killed on the battlefield, and then the corruption issues are coming around as well. So if I was president, Peter, if I was president, I would do what previous U.S. presidents have done. I would deploy my emissaries to the various corners of Europe to get buy-in. I would work the Democratic Party across the aisle, and I would work the media, and you create a situation where everybody's getting buy-in, and this takes strong statecraft, strong real leadership. You have to own the problem, not like Trump is doing at the moment. And then you go to Kiev, and you can say, it's a fait accompli, sign there, because this really is a dressing up a surrender agreement. Is what's really supposed to be happening. But by the end of it, by the time everyone takes their little bit off, Peter, there's going to be nothing left, and we're going to be back to zero again after Christmas.
Yeah, you know, a surrender agreement. I mean, you have to. It depends on who you ask who should be surrendering. That's one of the problems in all of this. You know, Alex, what Patrick described is very important because ever since this leaked plan went into the public sphere, what has really actually happened? You've had Ukrainians reacting, the Europeans with their hair on fire. Then you have Trump's opponents in the United States and legacy media. Everybody is squabbling. You know, the limited historical knowledge most of these people have, they instantly go to, it's Munich, okay? We need more Churchill. I mean, it's very infantile, the discourse. And what's most important here is the Russians technically haven't really even received it. So we've gone through so many news cycles of people squabbling over among themselves about what the one party that has been excluded from the circle has to say. I mean, this is just a circle jerk. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, so I think it's extremely difficult to judge where things stand at the moment. As Patrick said, Trump's approach is very unconventional. And I would agree with Patrick if, you know, what we got used to over the last few decades were circumstances where Europe and the United States were unquestionably allies. And let's say it was relatively easy to do this type of diplomacy and get buy-in from everyone. But this deal, this 28-point peace plan, is really putting Europe on the back foot because it's completely upending their, not security architecture, but insecurity architecture. And so I think that Trump has floated the idea out to get reactions. Predictably, and I expect that this was anticipated, the Europeans went completely hysterical. And, well, let's see that, you know, the 28-point peace plan is 28 points, each one of which could be expanded to a page or two or three pages. So it's basically a framework for negotiations. But I think it's a very positive and very encouraging framework because it really envisions a new security architecture, because it says that, you know, a full and comprehensive non-aggression agreement to be concluded between Russia, Ukraine, and Europe. And then in point 16, it says that Russia would legislatively enshrine non-aggression towards Europe and Ukraine. What this would do, it would completely blow up the Europeans' claims, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. Because yep. if Russia enshrines this into a law, then the whole reason for an escalation between Europe and Russia falls flat on its face.
Well, so, Alex, it would be nice in that point is that if the Europeans and the Americans would sign a non-aggression pact with Russia, it should go both ways. Okay, let me pull in Matthew here. Matthew, one of the things I found very curious over the last few news cycles that the Europeans huddled together and they came up with their own plan. Well, nobody asked them for a plan. No one is listening to their plan. Nobody cares, and there isn't a chair at the table. And Matthew, they earned that position, that not having a chair at the table. Matthew.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it would be wonderful if we actually had some actual politicians to deal with. As far as some, you know, just as to Patrick's remarks originally, but it demoralizes, I think, everybody looking at it, because we don't have any Chiracs. We don't have anybody, it seems, in positions of influence to make decisions in Europe that have human sentiments that you would recognize as somebody who make decisions, who actually is something more than just a wire machine like puppet that is wired do simply one thing, which is to continuously accelerate problem and undermine any possible constructive dialogue. So there's nothing really there, which causes that whole Europe is kind of ungovernable in that sense, ironically. So I don't know exactly what to do with that, or how people in actual decision making
I know what to do. Just ignore them. Okay. They're just noise. Okay. Alex, I saw you grinning from ear to ear as Matthew was speaking. Jump in. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, Matthew is right, because the leaders we have now in Europe are, not only low caliber, they appear very incompetent, long on ideology and zeal, and short on competence. And so, you know, their opposition might turn out to be paper thin. This is why I would give more credit to Trump and see how the situation plays out, because this is not going to be over tomorrow. European plan is obviously drafted with the idea of prolonging the war, hopefully long enough for European powers to get ready to join, you know, after they run out of the last Ukrainian, so that they can go sacrifice the Poles, the Estonians, you know, Baltic states, Romania, Moldova, whoever they can throw into the fight. But these regimes are all deeply unpopular. They're being led by Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, Friedrich Merz. And I think that they're not long for this world. I think that there's going to be a radical reform in Europe, or a disintegration of the European Union. Yeah. And I think that Trump just detonated the avalanche that is going to sweep them out.
Patrick,
can I just say one thing just quickly?
Go ahead.
Just quickly to chime in very, very briefly on that. I mean, yeah, their political capital is being completely wasted away. And you have like one of the highest ranking generals in France giving a speech saying that French have to be prepared to see their children die. Ursula von der Leyen. So, you know, is coming out saying how her kids should be happy if her kids would go and fight. But then when asked by the interviewer if her kids are military, she's like, no. But I mean, they're clearly completely alienating base that they're supposed to cater to. There's no love for these European politicians. I think that they're on the precipice also of their own disintegration in many ways.
From through the firewall there, that's RT, Crosstalk with Peter Lavelle. Peacefire, they call that episode this week, which is Patrick Henningsen, you just heard, Matt Errett and from Canada, and also Alex Craner from mainly, I think Alex is from Croatia. He sort of swaps between Croatia and Monaco. But anyway, I think fantastic, interesting insight there into what's really going on, which we're not getting in our mainstream press. Wonder why? Maybe because the British are some of the main instigators of that war.
And actually, there are war criminals walking our streets at the Ministry of Defence, in the military, and maybe some of them are Freemasons too, eh? It'd be interesting to know if there's any kind of correlation. Anyone like to do a graph from the Ministry of Defence? That would be great to see. Let's have a look. Just the one piece about Ukraine there. We're going to go plunging straight in with the Nazis and the occult. But the reason we're talking about Nazis pretty much straight away, because they're in the news this week. CJ Hopkins is a US journalist in working in Berlin these days. And he's writing all about how Germany is becoming Nazified. The modern version. He's written quite a lot about the COVID measures and how this is actually totalitarian, unjustified, and rather spooky and weird. So he's, but his comparisons to the Nazis are not just any old rubbish. He's looking at very closely at saying, well, look, these are the sorts of measures that the Nazis did in the early days, in the beginning days. So here he is talking to Kim Iverson. He's been arrested this week. No, I don't think he's arrested. Sorry, he had his computer taken and he was raided again because of this book. And as he points out here, when he's talking here on the Kim Iverson podcast show, that the Nazis are talked about quite a lot in the press. So why can't he talk about them? The thing is, in Germany, it's okay to talk about Alternative for Deutschland, which is their version of reform. In Germany, which is a nationalist party, the idea is that an anti-globalist party, you might just say. But it's okay to mention Nazis and say that they're Nazis, but it's not okay to say that the government are actually Nazis. Anyway, so very peculiar, weird Orwellian stuff going on. His book is called The Rise of the New Nazis. And so let's have a listen now to Kim Iverson interviewing CJ Hopkins, who was arrested, maybe not arrested. He's been arrested before, he's been put on trial, but this week they just seized his computers, CJ Hopkins' computers. Let's have a listen to him now.
What would you do if you were prosecuted, literally prosecuted, for speaking out against COVID tyranny? That's what happened to CJ Hopkins, an American living in Germany who's now been convicted under Nazi-era laws for the cover of his book, The Rise of the New Normal Reich. His so-called crime? To criticize the German government's COVID policies, comparing them to the totalitarianism of the Nazis. He's also just released a new follow-up book called Fear and Loathing in the New Normal Reich, documenting this disturbing rise of state censorship and thought policing across the West. CJ Hopkins has spent years fighting globalist groupthink, medical authoritarianism, and political hypocrisy. CJ Hopkins, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Kim. I appreciate it.
All right, let's start off with, we're going to talk about you being prosecuted in Germany for the cover of your book.
So I was a pretty vociferous COVID measures critic right from the very beginning, back in March and April of 2020. Wrote a lot of columns about it, collected a bunch of them in a book that was published in 2022, The Rise of the New Normal Reich. And my brilliant cover artist, Anthony Freda, and I, when we created the cover, what we did is we stole the cover of William Shirer's world-famous book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Old people like me will remember this cover. It's all black with red type. And down below the title, there's a little white circle with a swastika in it. It's the history of Nazi Germany. So we basically stole this cover, and then we put a medical-looking mask, one of the COVID masks, over the top of the swastika. So you see the medical mask, and then faintly behind it, there's a, what is that? It's a, oh my God, it's a swastika. So that was the cover of the book, published the book. Book did really well, Amazon bestseller in various countries. So everything was fine. Jump forward to, I think it was August of 2022. Yeah, that's right. In Germany, they were having a big debate about, should we continue to force everyone to wear medical-looking masks in public all the time? I know it ended earlier in the States, but in Germany, the mandates were still ongoing. There was a big uproar. Germans were like, no, we have to keep the mask mandates. Everyone has to be forced to wear these medical masks at all time. And I put a couple of tweets out. I used the cover art of the book And one tweet, I basically was just saying that the masks are ideological conformity symbols, and that's all they really are. It's theater. And the other tweet, I made fun of the German health minister, Karl Lauterbach, used one of his quotes. He was quoted as saying, you know, the masks always send out a signal. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly my point, Carl. That's what they're for, is to send out a signal. So I sent that tweet as well. And I used the cover art of the book on both tweets. A little bit later, and this all happened within a 48-hour period, the tweets were censored by Twitter. My book was banned by Amazon in Germany, in Austria, and the Netherlands. It was also essentially banned in German bookstores. You can't get it in German bookstores anymore. And a criminal investigation was opened, and I received a notice a little bit later that I was charged with basically disseminating Nazi propaganda for using the swastika in this cover artwork of my book. So that was the beginning of it. This criminal investigation was launched. I got a lawyer. We protested, you know, filed briefs back, ended up in court and in district court here in Berlin, where I was acquitted, of course. A lot of Americans don't know. They think that, you know, displaying swastikas and, you know, Nazi iconography is completely banned in Germany. And it is if you're a Nazi. Right. There's a ban on it if you're promoting Nazism or neo-Nazism. Mm-hmm. But of course, there are numerous exceptions to this ban. You know, you couldn't teach a history class or show a Quentin Tarantino movie or a Rammstein video if there weren't exceptions to the ban.
Got it.
One of the exceptions to the ban is if you're using the symbol to counter or to protest against anti-constitutional activity. Yeah, then you are allowed to, which is, of course, exactly what I was doing.
Right.
Art is another exception to the ban. So the judge in my first trial recognized all of that, and she acquitted me. She thought I was an idiot, and she told me so in court. But, you know, she said, Mr. Hopkins, you're a jerk, basically, but what you did is not illegal. And so I was acquitted.
Okay, can I ask you, were you surprised when you were first charged? Or did you expect it, knowing that... Oh, you were shocked. So you didn't think...
No, I mean,
you know the law in Germany, right? You know that displaying swastikas is very serious in Germany. They crack down on this heavily. So when you chose to use this as the artwork for the cover of your book, I mean, did you even have a second thought? Like, you know, are they going to maybe come after me for this? Or was there no thinking of that at all?
No, there really wasn't, because what people have to understand is swastikas are displayed all the time when they fall under these exceptions to the ban. I was going to give you an example later, but I'll give you an example. I'll give you the example now. Shortly before my second trial, which is what I'm going to get to in a second, Der Spiegel, which is the big, you know, world famous magazine that everybody knows, they printed a cover of their magazine, which was exactly the same artistic concept that I used on the cover of my book. The cover was a big, fat swastika covered by a German flag, right? And I think the question was, you know, is it happening again?
Mm-hmm.
Stern, another big German magazine, at the same time, they printed a cover with a big fat swastika floating in a martini glass. And what people need to understand is the authorities and the cultural establishment, they do this all the time. They use swastikas all the time. The reason it wasn't a problem for Der Spiegel or Stern is because they were using their swastikas to compare the AfD party, Alternative for Deutschland party, to the Nazis, whereas I was using it to compare the German authorities to the Nazis.
Right.
This kind of brings me to my second trial. Another thing that people, Americans, are usually shocked by is in Germany, the prosecution can appeal an acquittal, which they did. The prosecutors didn't like my acquittal. They appealed it. We went to appeals court. And of course, the appeals court overturned my acquittal and convicted me of this hate crime, basically.
What was the grounds for their appeal? Like, what did they say? They said, oh, no, he actually was promoting Nazism. I mean, what could they possibly say?
Well, it's a funny argument. The prosecutor basically said, of course, you know, Mr. Hopkins is not a Nazi. He's not promoting, you know, he didn't mean to promote Nazism. You know, they know I'm an old lefty. I'm an author. I've been writing anti-authoritarian literature for a long time. They said, okay, you know, Mr. Hopkins is not a Nazi, but when he sent these two tweets out, he didn't make it clear that he was criticizing the Nazis and not the German government. All right. So therefore his tweets could, you know, nonetheless promote Nazism.
So by that logic, do they then think that the AfD party are Nazis? And so they're saying you can criticize them for being Nazis because they are Nazis, even though they're not Nazis, obviously. But they're saying, but they're like not. So only if they think that this is like the Nazis, it's okay to use it. But if they don't agree that this is like the Nazis, then apparently you're not allowed to use it.
That you got it exactly right, Kim. That's,
because neither
that's
are
exactly
actual Nazis. Right. The whole point of using the symbolism is to say, warning, yes, it's dressed up in different clothing. They call themselves different names, but it's the same exact sort of idea. So obviously, neither, you know, the actual German government today is not Nazis. Obviously, the AfD party's not Nazis, but you could say, but it's getting close. It's getting like that, right? And they're saying, no, only if we agree with you. Wow, that's interesting.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, come on, let's go back again. I'm old enough, you know, how long have people been comparing people to the Nazis? I mean, right. I remember back in the war on terror, you know, and every protest that I went to had big pictures of Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and all of them, you know, done up as the Nazis. I mean, this comparison, I've been criticized for it, and I take the criticism. You know, people say, you know, CJ, it's way over the top to compare, you know, what happened during the COVID years, you know, to the Nazis. And I said, look, I just chose the Nazis because they are the most recognizable form of totalitarianism
right.
that we have. My focus and what I wrote about mostly, I made the point over and over again, is of course, the current German government, the current Australian government, the current U.S. government, British government, of course, they're not Nazis, you know, but what they're doing bears all of the hallmarks of totalitarianism.
Right.
And that's the comparison that I was making. The German government, you know, doesn't appreciate that. Comparing them to totalitarians, to the Nazis, is absolutely verboten. But sure, if you want to compare the AfD to the Nazis, they agree with that, so it's allowed.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. We have to be able to make the comparisons. That's the point of learning history. The point is to say, warning, it's happening again. Here's the warning signs. And you have to be able to make those comparisons, saying the warning signs for the rise of the Nazis are here once again. Here's the warning signs. I mean, if we can't do that, then it will happen again for sure. So they're just in their effort to not, I don't even know what their, I guess their point in banning swastikas, in banning any sort of Nazi ideology in Germany, because they obviously don't have free speech. You're not allowed to say you're a Nazi or support the Nazis in any way, right? But their goal in that is to, I guess, clamp down on history of what happened and to ensure that it doesn't repeat again. But in their attempt to ensure it doesn't repeat again, they are ensuring it will repeat again. I mean, that's the irony of it.
Well, I look at it a little bit differently, Kim. A lot of people interpret it that way, as if the Germans are just being over-enthusiastic. I surprise a lot of people because I'm known as a free speech absolutist, and I am, but I make an exception for Germany. I actually don't have a problem with this ban in Germany. I don't have a problem. I don't want to see neo-Nazis marching around in the streets of Germany waving swastikas.
Yeah.
It hasn't been long enough yet. But the point that I always try to make is this really isn't a case of the German authorities just being over-enthusiastic or being overly literal. What they did is they wanted to punish a relatively prominent COVID dissident. They wanted to make an example of somebody, and I'm not the only one. They've made examples of other people just like me. The guy that organized the big protests in 2020 was put in jail for 9 months. They seized all of his assets. He's still fighting the case in court. There are other people like me. The point is, they wanted to make an example of somebody. They wanted to punish somebody. And so they found something that they could use legally to justify the punishment that they wanted to dish out.
The crackdown on speech, we're seeing this not just in your case and what's gone on in Germany, but we're also seeing this throughout the UK, right? We see the police showing up to people's homes because of social media posts. Here in the United States now, we're seeing the crackdown on anti-Semitism, right? If you are opposed to Israel, if you're not aligned with Israel, then we're going to crack down on you essentially and call it anti-Semitism. So we're seeing this sort of, it feels like the facade of free speech is coming crumbling down. The facade of Western democracies, Western freedom, that we are free from government overreach and tyranny, that seems to be crumbling right in front of our eyes. Do you think this is new, or is this something that's been going on for a really long time? We just weren't paying attention to it, or people were paying attention to it, but it's just now with social media, we can amplify the fact that this is happening. Or is this a turn, like a change, a shift?
It's a shift. You just walked right into my wheelhouse, because this is what I've been writing about for years. I started with I was a playwright for many years, and I wrote a novel in 2017. But I started writing my my political satire and sometimes a little bit more serious theory 2016. And at first, what first got my attention and got me started doing that was this populist uprising in Europe. It started with Brexit and the rise of various right populist parties in Europe, and then of course Trump, the whole Trump phenomenon, what have you. And I covered the establishment's reaction to that. I had written previously a little bit about the war on terror. Let me try to make this concise and make it clear. I think what we are experiencing is new, and it really started about 35 years ago. What happened about 35 years ago is the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was kind of the last real ideological adversarial equation that existed. What happened is around 35 years ago, we became a single ideology world. And, I call it globocap sometimes. It's global capitalism. And that really is absolutely unprecedented in human history. We've never been in a place in history where the entire world is dominated by a single ideology. Mm-hmm. When a single power system, when a single ideology dominates an entire territory, and it does not have any outside adversaries anymore, any outside enemies, or any outside ideological adversaries, it really has nothing left to do other than, the military term is clear and hold, right? I don't know if you're familiar with this term, any occupying force. Okay, so you've conquered a country, you're occupying the country. What do? You survey the territory, you look for little pockets of resistance, and you neutralize them. And at the same time, you spread and you try to create uniformity with your new ideology in the country that you're occupying. That's what's happening. It's just happening throughout the entire planet.
Yeah.
The war on terror was kind of the beginning of it. There was that early period where, Yugoslavia and what have you in Eastern Europe, and the establishment didn't quite know what was going on because they were in a new territory, a new place. And then, war on terror comes along because there's a big pocket of resistance. to the domination of global capitalism in the Middle East. And so that we had the war on terror for 16 years or what have you. And then suddenly in 2016 or thereabouts, oh, the establishment turns around and says, oh, now we're getting all of this resistance rising up, you know, not in the Middle East, but right here at home in Western Europe, in the United States, in Western countries. And this is when that same machine, that same clear and hold machine gets turned on the Western public. And a lot of people have written about this without the context, but you can see the shift in 2016. This is when the heavy censorship of social media starts. This is when the, you know, just the crackdown on dissent in Western societies begins. It rolls right into the COVID era, which I've written, people can read my earlier books. I've written countless essays about this. It rolls right into the COVID era. It rolls right into the, you know, the removal of Trump after his first term and the Biden inauguration spectacle where all of DC was locked down and occupied by soldiers. No one was allowed to attend. There was a field of flags where the public usually is. I could go on and on about this. What I believe we're experiencing, Kim, and it's hard for people to get their heads around it, is we're experiencing this new system, which is really a global system, a global ideological system, doing the only thing that it really has left to do, which is evolving into a new form of totalitarianism. It's not Nazism. It's not Stalinism. It's different. It has a lot of the same features. It has a lot of differences, and I've written a lot about this. But I believe what we are experiencing is this new global system evolving into a much more totalitarian form. And that's how I interpret pretty much everything that's happening these days.
I think a bit of a real insight there into modern German society. So it's very important, of course. This is taboo to talk about this sort of thing. That's CJ Hopkins there talking to Kim Iverson on her show about the rise of the new Nazis in Germany. This is his book, which he's getting horrendous harassment for, and makes the point, it's such an important point to make, isn't it? Well, it's okay to talk about Alternative for Deutschland, AfD, as Nazis, but not the government, eh? Well, that's a bit funny. Anyway, let's go back to 1991 now, and the voice of Patrick Allen narrating this programme. It's a brilliant series called The Occult History of the Third Reich. If you've not seen it, do, from 1991. And I'll be putting some links up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk so you can do exactly that, download it or whatever and watch the programme on the series of four programmes. And this is an extract from the very first one, The Enigma of the Swastika. And it's, I was, you know, quite amazed. It takes you through chronologically the rise of the Nazis, where they came from, the massively important role of Helena Blavatsky and the Theosophists. That's where the Nazis came from, Theosophy.
The Versailles Treaty will fatally undermine the authority of the new Weimar Republic. The ministers who signed its terms will become known as the November Criminals. As food supplies dwindle and a once proud nation is reduced to dependence and misery, Germany threatens to descend into anarchy. The infant Weimar Republic quickly becomes a battleground of warring factions. In the major cities, revolutionary socialist republics are declared by councils of workers and soldiers. Nationalists and monarchist groups muster private armies and mobilize for counter-revolution. Behind the factions on both sides is the hidden hand of conspiracy. Among the many shadowy groups organizing nationalist counter-revolution is the wealthy and powerful Thule Society. Thule is the Munich Lodge of the Nationalists and Anti-Semitic German Order, the German order is dedicated to the occult teachings of Guido von List. On November the 9th, 1918, Rudolf von Sebottendorf, Master of Thule, addresses a hastily convened meeting of the Lodge. Socialist republics have been declared in both Munich and Berlin. Yesterday, we experienced the collapse of everything which is familiar, dear, and valuable to us. I am determined to pledge Thule to this struggle. Our God is Valvata. His rune is the Arun. The Arun signifies Aryan, primal fire, the sun, and the eagle. Thule will fight until the swastika rises victoriously out of the icy darkness. In the following months, along with other nationalist groups, Thule stockpiles weapons and trains volunteers. On April the 30th, 1919, 20,000 men, including strong detachments armed and led by Thule, storm Munich in a bloody counter-revolution. On the helmets of many nationalist volunteers is the emblem of the swastika. The success of Thule in the 1919 Munich counter-revolution would have far-reaching consequences for the Germany of the 1920s. A shadowy organization devoted to arcane rituals and the creation of an Aryan empire would attract support from the highest levels of German society. The secret German order, parent order of Thule, was founded in 1912. It was and would remain virulently anti-Semitic and anti-democratic. The membership of the Thule and of all the lodges of the German order is drawn from the ranks of aristocrats, industrialists, lawyers, judges, and medical men. All are required to prove that they and their spouses are of pure Aryan blood. Applicants must submit details of hair, eye, and skin color. Hair must be blonde to dark blonde. Eyes must be blue or light brown. The skin must be fair. For membership of the Berlin Lodge, even the shape of the skull is taken into account. By the autumn of 1918, Rudolf von Sebottendorf, master of the Thule Lodge, had attempted to extend the influence of Thule's ideas by secretly sponsoring the formation of a workers' discussion group. Unknown to most members of the group, its chairman, Karl Harrer, would belong to Thule. The most active member of the workers' group is a locksmith, Anton Drexler. By the end of 1918, Drexler had proposed that the workers' circle be formed into a new political party. The Thule chairman agreed. On January the 5th, 1919, the new party is formally founded in a Munich tavern, the Fürstenfelderhof. It is to be called the German Workers' Party. On September the 12th, 1919, 10 months after the foundation of the party, an army spy is sent by his superiors to attend one of its meetings. The spy is a 30-year-old Austrian war veteran. His name is Adolf Hitler. Within weeks, Hitler has joined the party, become a regular speaker at beer hall political meetings, and has been appointed to the party's steering committee. Within 4 months, the party has changed its name. It has become the National Socialist German Workers' Party. On May the 20th, 1920, the swastika was formally adopted as the symbol of the new Nazi party. The form chosen, straight-armed and anti-clockwise, was chosen by Adolf Hitler himself. Until now, the nationalist swastika had no set direction. The swastika talismans of the Great War were vertical and tilted, clockwise and anti-clockwise. Hermann Göring, future chief of the German Air Force as a nationalist volunteer of 1919, wore a vertical anti-clockwise swastika. In the ranks of the nationalist counter-revolutionaries, both clockwise and anti-clockwise forms were commonplace. The curved swastika of Thule, chosen from the many popularized by Guido von List, will not be forgotten by the party to which Thule gave birth. it will live on the belt buckles of the brown-shirted stormtroopers. The ceremonial swords of the Luftwaffe will bear the Thule swastika. Decorations for anti-partisan warfare on the Eastern Front will display the Thule dagger and the Kerb swastika. Whatever the form in which the swastika will appear in the banners and regalia of National Socialism, its meaning will remain the same. It is the meaning claimed for it by Madame Blavatsky and Guido von Liszt. It is the sign of creation, the sign of the mystical destiny of Aryan man. By the 1920s, the spread of Charles Darwin's theories of evolution has had a profound impact on nationalist consciousness. A new explanation for the differences between cultures and for the rise and fall of civilizations is now possible. Increasingly, laws of inheritance are believed to be the key to history. The artistic achievements of a nation, its courage in war, its temperament, even its spiritual life, are all believed to be the legacy of race. It is a belief that will culminate in the official Nazi doctrine that each race has its soul and each soul its race. The myth of the Aryan, developed in the occult teachings of Madame Blavatsky and Guido von Liszt, has by the late 1920s spread throughout Europe, the United States and Britain. And with it, fascination with the swastika. The Stories of India by the British author Rudyard Kipling appear emblazoned with the seal of the swastika. In Scotland, the discovery of swastika markings in a Pictish cave inspired the creation of the swastika kilt pin. In the United States, costly earrings and brooches appear in the form of the swastika. During the Great War, the British War Savings Drive has a swastika as its official emblem. Its administrators are awarded swastika lapel badges in recognition of their services to the nation. By 1930, members of the British Druidic cults display swastikas on their ceremonial robes. In 1932, an English periodical appears with the title The Superman. It is devoted to physical culture, and on its cover is a border of swastikas. The Superman, as well as features on sport and health, carries articles by respected British scientists, warning of the racial contamination of Saxon Britain.
Und im euren jungen Gehirn brennt derselbe Geist, der uns beherrscht.
The Nuremberg Rally of 1934. The Führer, addressing the massed ranks of the Hitler Youth, speaks of Germany, of the blood, and of the continuity of the race. In the coming year, a series of new German laws will be signed into existence by Adolf Hitler. The First Reich Law of Citizenship will divide the people of Germany into two classes. Those of pure Aryan blood will be full citizens of the Reich. Non-Aryans will be reduced to mere subjects of the state. A second law, the Law for the Protection of German Blood and German Honor, will forbid pure-blooded Aryans from marrying people of Jewish descent. Soon after, the measure will be extended to forbid intermarriage between Aryans and all non-Aryans. The Germanic vision of Guido von Liszt is becoming a reality.
So a fascinating insight there. That's the programme is called The Documentary of the Occult History of the Third Reich. There is Patrick Allen doing the narration, 1991 documentary, and that is from the first of the four episodes. That's The Enigma of the Swastika. And isn't it interesting how the British got into the swastika? Oh, God, it's so awful. In the run-up to the Second World War, so I suppose these are the people who are into the swastika that were keeping Winston Churchill off the airwaves. He was kept completely away from the BBC, etc., in the run-up to the war. And then suddenly, you know, he was a sort of almost like a set up as a kind of cult figure himself. You know, this is the guy that will really, he hates Adolf Hitler, you know, and he wants a war. No, well, I don't know if he even said that he did want a war, but the point is that he was kept away from the airwaves. And
And people at the time were going, oh, isn't it nice? I'm going to put a little swastika on. They're so cool. They're like an amazing talisman. But anyway, some fascinating insight in that program. And do you know what? The Dennis Wheatley quote I should probably give to you, but I haven't got it handy, is where he says in one of his novels, actually, he's a whole passage in there, where he says, well, one of his characters in his novel says, that Hitler is the prototype for the Antichrist. Of course, you know, as you just heard, obviously he was being treated as a god. And it's amazing that it's possible in the modern age to actually get people, political leaders, maybe spiritual leaders, etc., into the position, almost like the sort of mega celebrities, you know, like everyone loves the Beatles, everyone loves Madonna, you know, whatever. But to actually turn these political leaders into gods is what they did with Adolf Hitler. So watch out for that in the future, ladies and gentlemen. A prototype, a test run, maybe. So next, we'll get into the occult proper. And so we're going to hear from David Livingstone in a minute. But first, this long-threatened piece from Cynthia Chung. This is in Breaking History. This is where she really talks about this Kaldunovi-Kalergi plan and the roots of the Crusader revival. So many people point out, I try to do it as often as I can, that the idea of the Israel project, setting it all up and having this Crusader state, is a kind of, it's like medieval, isn't it? We were doing it in Europe in the 10th, 11th century. And 12th and 13th century, as the Crusades were chugging across. But we've done it again, and this time we've done it properly, man. So anyway, let's have a listen to Cynthia Chung. Also very good. Matt Eric, I think, may be on here, but this is mainly Cynthia. And this is called the Breaking History Podcast. Always very, very good. And this is the one about the roots of the Crusader revival. Thank you, Cynthia.
You open up your book with a whole exposition on a figure that very few Westerners are aware of Count Richard Kudenhove Kalergi. And you also republished that chapter in a series on your Substack called A Modern Day Crusade for the Holy Land, part 1, 2, and 3. Which is brilliantly written. I think you even added a few additional things. Part 2 is on a reformed anti-Semitism, fascism for Europe, fascism for Zionism. It's a great series. Again, it's part of the book, but Count Richard Kudenhove Kalergi, is somebody who is so bloody important, not just for the creation of what becomes the European Union, but lays out a blueprint that I think has been put into operation and has been followed pretty closely for the past century. And yeah, I got that picture here. Here, I'll just play it. I'll put it on the, or here, that, there it is.
Yeah.
That's the flag.
He wrote several autobiographies, and he's quite honest, I find, and explicit as to his intention.
Can I show a picture of him?
Sure. Yeah.
That's a painting of him with
I've never actually seen that painting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That tells you that there's a lot of Freemasonry symbolism there.
Oh, yeah. Clearly high-level Freemasonic obsessed, yeah, initiate, for sure. And there's, yeah, a book that he published on Pan-Europa and or Europe Unite, and his special flag.
Yeah, so that flag was supposed to be So he's the one who is the father of Pan-Europeanism, which would eventually become the European Union. And his idea for the Pan-European flag was the Apollo sun and the Crusader cross. And he's very explicit in his autobiography. So he wrote, "I chose the sign of the Red Cross superimposed on a golden sun as the emblem of our movement. The Red Cross, which had been the flag of the medieval Crusaders, seemed the oldest known symbol of supranational European brotherhood. In more recent times, it has also gained recognition as a symbol of international relief work. The sun was chosen to represent the achievements of European culture in helping to illuminate the world, thus Hellenism and Christianity. The cross of Christ and the son of Apollo figured side by side as the twin enduring pillars of European civilization. It's going to be too much to go over in this discussion, the relevance of Apollo, but just to say that Apollo is very relevant in the cult of Delphi. And if you've seen the movie 300, King Leonidas has to like pay tribute before he goes to war, right? Like the cult of Delphi was basically anyone, and it wasn't just Greeks, but mostly Greeks, you would have to go to this cult and you would have to tell them your battle plans and everything in order to have like a sort of, acceptance. Like the gods had to like, you know, bestow, their favor on you. And there's often prophecy involved, you know, in this, this cult of Delphi, the promise of prophecy. But you see in the 300 movie, which is actually quite historically accurate, Leonidas has to actually pay these people, who are like very corrupt priests who are clearly intoxicating this young girl who's babbling nonsense. And, all to say is that that's quite a lot of power that all of these people have to come to you to share their military plans. You know, it's basically an intelligence center. So the cult of Apollo, but there's also a lot of weird stuff as well with the cult of Apollo.
Apollo also becomes the prototype for, he's a solar deity, right? And he becomes the prototype for Lucifer and later on as well. Yeah. Just as a side note, not to really belabor that, but just to say it's.
And the Templars are connected to this and there's a lot of Freemasonic connection to this, but it's a big one to talk about, which we're not going to really have enough time. Mm-hmm. But Kalergi is very explicit that his formation of the Pan-European Union is, here's another quote. First of all, he highlights that his Kuttenhofer line reaches back to the 11th century, and that they were part of the First Crusade. He's very proud of this. And they would, you know, become counts in the 18th century. He says, after the fall of the Roman Empire, the Crusades represented the most vigorous display of European solidarity. And he says, this league, and I'm going to explain it in a moment, but he's talking about a league of nations that needs to also be formed in the in reaction to the First World War. But he says this league will have two objectives. First, to ensure permanent peace within the Christian world. And secondly, to rally the armed strength of Europe for the reconquest of the Holy Land and the Mediterranean. So he's very explicit that his idea of pan-Europe, which became the European Union, was to have the Holy Land conquest as one of the big issues. Now, the League of Nations is actually what is responsible for the Balfour Declaration, which created eventually the State of Israel. And really quickly, I'll explain what the League of Nations is first, and then I'll address why what actually was fascists behind. If you look at like the names in the Balfour Declaration, besides Rothschild, they're all like very clearly anti-Semitic people. So you would wonder like, why are a bunch of anti-Semitics who would later on become like very overtly pro-Nazi and pro-Mussolini, why were they the ones who created, you know, what would become Israel? But the League of Nations was basically, so after the First World War, you had the Treaty of Versailles, which was a form of economic warfare that also was like, basically gave Hitler what he needed in order to form the kind of extremism and desperation that would become the Nazi Germany. Kalergi acknowledges this in his autobiography. But after the First World War, there was also this talk of like how we need a League of Nations, and they were kind of selling it as like democratic republics, but it was obviously not. It was basically about six empires. It was going to be a kind of Habsburg Empire, a British Empire, an American Empire, which would be all of North and South America. You'd have a Russian Empire, Chinese, Japanese, Arabia, and Africa were going to be satrapies, and thus they were not considered, you know, to have any kind of civilization of their own. And Britain very clearly is brought up by Clergy and also Churchill that Britain will be an exception to all these other empires, where they have a piece of Britain in each one of these empires. And so they're like the top empire. There isn't a hierarchy of empires in this vision. So what I see like playing out is very much a repetition of what they were trying to push in the early 20th century. And people have to realize that when we're talking about returning back to Roman, ideologies or Roman principles, for me, this is sort of a trap to accept empire, and especially a world empire. But people have to understand that you as an average person are going to forfeit your rights in a system like that. That's not a system that's going to protect the rights that you see today are coming under attack. Because there's a reason why these things are happening, because they want to actually attack the sovereign nation state construct. So the League of Nations was like a form of sophistry that they were using, saying like, oh, well, don't you want a United States of Europe? That's how Clergy was selling it, which is absurd, because like the United States started out as 13 colonies who then started to communicate, form a common currency, you know, a banking system, forms of trade that allowed them to become a nation state. And we really take this for granted. Italy only became a sovereign nation state in the late 1800s. And even then it was like, it was not like how the Americans were able to form this in such a short amount of time. Germany was also only a sovereign nation state by the end of the 1800s. Like these countries were mostly provinces that were constantly warring with each other for centuries and did not actually have a common identity, as a people that were united. With an economic system and a political system and a civilizational system that was working together. And that was actually something that was considered a threat to empire. The United States was the one that created this great pushback with the American system of economics. So like Friedrich List in Germany, for instance, was directly putting in place American system economics, which is what was giving Germany its economic sovereignty. And that's why Germany was such a powerhouse in the 20th century, was because of direct adoption of the American system economics. Like Tsar Alexander II was it's very public that he actually, Britain and France were saying that they were thinking of intervening during the Civil War. And Tsar Alexander II said, if you do this, I will consider it a casus belli, because he wanted the United States to stay whole. He did not want it to be divided, because he knew it would be weaker. And he knew, he said this in an interview with Wharton Barker, that this, it wasn't because of any particular love of the United States, but recognition of what it represented as a system of economics that was opposed to the British imperialism that was like looting other countries, destroying the Indian textiles and having a monopoly on cotton at the time. Is one of those points.
Okay, Cynthia Chung there with the Breaking History podcast from Montreal. I think it's coming out of Montreal. It's Canadian anyway. Canadian Patriot Press. I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And we'll wind up this week with David Livingstone. And if you're a real keen David Livingstone fan, you probably would have heard the whole interview that I put up last week. But here he gets into this whole, like, I had no idea about this. It's lovely to learn things about, isn't it? This concept of Charles Manson. Well, I knew that the Sharon Tate murder and the murders, killings around that time, what they were doing was they were trying to make out that it was black people killing white people. They were trying to start a race war. This was like, you know, it was almost like they were signalling, look, this is the end to the fun and games of the 1960s. Everything's now going dark, right? And we're getting nasty, we're getting crazy. And there's quite clearly something satanic about all of this. So Charles Manson is doing what David Livingston explains here. Charles Manson is doing exactly what people like Nick Land advocate, which is trying to accelerate the end of the world, cause chaos. That is exactly what these people are. They are chaos merchants. They're lords of chaos. They're kings of chaos. Chaos is their objective.
Accelerationism is old enough to have arrived in waves, which is to say insistently or recurrently, and each time the challenge is more urgent. Amongst its predictions is the expectation that you'll be too slow to deal with it coherently. Yet if you fumble the question it poses because rushed, you lose, perhaps very badly. It's hard. For our purposes here, you are standing in as a bearer of the opinions of mankind. Time pressure, by its very nature, is difficult to think about. Typically, while the opportunity for deliberation is not necessarily presumed, it is at least, with overwhelming likelihood, mistaken for a historical constant rather than a variable. If there was ever time to think, we think, there still is and always will be. The definite probability, the allotment of time to decision-making, is undergoing systematic compression, a neglected consideration even among those paying explicit and exceptional attention to the increasing rapidity of change. So he's really saying that they're way ahead of us, and everything we try and do is pointless. There is no alternative. There is going to be a total control and ownership by the people with money. They will just basically run and own everything. Capital will be sovereign.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking about Satanists, right? So that's what this is very important to remember, that Satanists are not atheists. And they believe in the existence of God, Jehovah, of the Bible. They believe in this, in the history of the Bible. They believe in the prophecies of the Bible, but they choose the opposing camp. So what they're trying to do, and this is what Ben-Gurion is describing, is they're trying to bring about the fulfillment of, this is what Zionism is, right? This is what we are saying, is that it's Zionism is the idea that you can force the hand of God, that you have to make prophecies happen. This goes back to Isaac Luria. He's the first one, well, probably not the first one, but he's the first prominent one to propose that idea. I'm going to read you from something from Nick's friend, his new best friend, Dugin. So in the fourth political theory, Dugin said, "The end times and the eschatological meaning of politics will not realize themselves on their own. We will wait for the end in vain. The end will never come if we wait for it, and it will never come if we do not. This is essential because history, time, and reality have special strategies to avoid judgment day, or rather, they have a special strategy, a revolutionary maneuver that will create the impression that everyone has come to a realization and understanding. This is the huge arsenal of Heidegger's noch nicht, or eternal not yet. If fourth political practice is not able to realize the end times, then it would be invalid. The end of days should come. It will not come by itself. It is a task. It is not a certainty. It is active metaphysics. It is a practice."
And is Dugin approving of that? Is he just observing it?
No, that's his belief system. This is the basis of Dugin's whole philosophy, which he's called the Empire of the End Times. Right? This is where it gets really, really complicated. If you understand all these people, how they all connect together. And this is where Land's acceleration comes in. So this is all goes back. So, you know, we talked about there's many manifestations of Satanism in many forms, like Hermeticism, so on and so forth, right? The most recent one in our century is traditionalism. This is a whole idea that goes all the way back to the Renaissance, but most recently was popularized by René Guénon, and then has, like, had, you know, various modifications over the centuries, and it's very closely related to fascism. And Dugin is really the modern exemplar of this whole tradition, and it links all kinds of people. If you look at Dugin's friends, so he's friends all over the place. We talked about this before. I'm not going to repeat, you know, all the connections that he has, but basically he's very much at the center of the Luciferian International. And one of the key organizations that to publicize a lot of this traditionalist thinking is a publishing company called Inner Traditions. And so this is where you get the whole nexus of all these people. A lot of the people who are associated with sort of the ancient aliens nonsense, a lot of the sort of like these, what they call New Egyptologists, you know, sort of a lot of the New Age mumbo jumbo. They also publish Vola's books, because Dugin is a major proponent of Julius Evola. And this is now where you start to see the link now to the accelerationist movement. Nick is considered really sort of the godfather, modern godfather of accelerationism, but it really goes back to a guy named James Mason in a magazine that he used to operate called The Siege. And so James Mason was a member of the American Nazi Party for a while, and then he befriended Charles Manson, and they created some kind of publication together. I can't remember what it was called. And So he was the first to promote this idea of accelerationism, but it really goes back to Charles Manson and the whole idea of the Process Church. So again, Process Church now with many, many links, right? I recommend anybody who's looking into it to read Maury Terry's book. There's also a half-decent documentary about him on Netflix if you want to give a vague idea of what his research is about, but it's really amazing. So if you want to talk about what Satanism looked like today and, you know, satanic ritual abuse, he treats all that in its connection to the Process Church, because that's what Manson was inspired by. What's really interesting is that, what's her name? I can't remember what her name was. The two founders, the female founder, something McLean, Marianne McLean, I think it was what it was on the founder, and de Grimstone, who were the founders of the Process Church. So she was actually one of the many sort of ladies that were pimped by a guy named, now I can't remember his name, but who basically was behind the Profumo scandal. And so he basically operated out of the Cliveden House, I think it was called, a mansion that used to be owned by the Astor family. This traces back to, so Lady Astor is a whole connection to the Cliveden set. They were all part of the sort of network of collaborationists during, or, you know, what's the word, appeasers, or who were trying to find appeasement with the Nazi Germany. Eventually, he inherited the right to live, I guess, or to at least use the Cliveden house, which is where he held, according to what's her name? The lady who was at the center of the Profumo scandal. She described basically these...
That's Christine Keeler. Yeah.
Thank you. That's her. She described these, what she called, Masonically themed black magic parties. And so he was also friends with Billy Hitchcock, who funded Timothy Leary's stay at the Millbrook Mansion in Maine, which sort of became his headquarters. So, of course, now the whole idea of what Manson was trying to do with the killings, the killing of Sharon Tate and that whole group, was to basically to ignite a race war that would effectively accelerate our move towards the end times. And what's interesting, of course, is that Sharon Tate was the wife of Roman Polanski, who was the director of Rosemary's Baby, which featured Anton LaVey, who was the head of Church of Satan. Rosemary's Baby was produced by Robert Evans, who was connected to Roy Red, and who was one of the leaders, according to Maury Terry, of the Process Church. So just to say that this is the whole network that we're talking about. So now Siege had a particular, this, I go to all this, anybody's looking for it, I go through all this in a chapter called The Black Order in volume 5 of my Ordo Ab Cowl book.
That is, and was, David Livingston, and looking there at acceleration, Nick Land to Charles Manson, or even Charles Manson to Nick Land. So that's all, as thanks as always to David Livingston. I mean, in the longer version, he does talk about the Phoenicians and the Druids, and I must put something up on my show page, our show page, about the links, because it clearly looks as if the Druids were Phoenicians. I have this sort of, I don't know if it's a fantasy or it's just an easy way of seeing things, that the many people in the ancient Britons had come here because they wanted to get away from these maniacs, and then these Phoenicians in their ships came round, didn't they, through the Straits of Gibraltar, up and down the Atlantic East Coast, and they settled on islands. This is one of the things the Phoenicians did, is they took over little islands and made them into little fortresses, and then started trading with the people on the land. But they weren't just trading, they were infiltrating, they were finding out who was in charge, murdering them, and then taking over their systems, politics, very much like, in a way, our neo-colonial era since World War II has been doing. And, you know, they were fairly subtle and evil and nasty, the Phoenicians, and they also introduced this alphabet, which it's quite obvious that much of the language, the Celtic languages. So I will put a link up to this on our show page, even though that's not what that piece is about. The longer piece with David, again, it's been a revelation for me. I hope it's of interest to you too. So that's all we've got time for this week, as they say, and we'll be back next week, hopefully with a live program, inshallah. You'll find all of the details on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where you can find my books. For Christmas, I suppose I should have managed to get together a bunch of books for that, because there's been some interesting ones up. One that springs to mind is the one about Tampon Charlie and his finances, by Norman Baker, the former prisons minister. Very interesting guy he is. But of course, you can get my books, which are The Traitors of Ireland, which spells out all of the details of the Nazi-British deals at the end of World War II for the creation of a Fourth Reich, a financial Fourth Reich, which we're dealing with today, in my view. Don't believe me, though. And then there's my other book, which is more like a kind of coffee table thing, which is called The Siege of Heaven Reader, and that is an anthology of articles about secret government right the way from the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell, right the way up and through until the Princess Diana assassination. So, thank you very much for joining us, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
I needed the rest from telling you you looked attractive each time you undressed. You didn't help matters much as you walked out my life without leaving the key. You squeezed the blood from the stone, took the good from the bad, like the 36 pieces of cheap cutlery.
You just take, you just take,
pile on the agony.
You just take, you just take,
pile on the agony. I bet you're in a bed of roses, lying in a heap, surrounded by your new possessions, so tasteless and cheap. And I am desperately lonely and certainly homely with nothing to do, because the lads and the match and the Friday night stags were just some of the things that I gave up for you.
You just
just take.
You just take.
And pile on the agony.
You just take.
You just take.
You just take.
And pile on the agony. Time of our lives. You've taken passion from compassion. You've taken the bliss and done it all for independence. But there's no such thing. And I still stand here and stare at the chair over there where you used to sit. And I could get someone in to sit there in your place, but they wouldn't fit.
You just take.
You just take.
You just take.
Pile on the agony.
You just take.
You just take.
Boogie with the- my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside. Down by the riverside.
Yeah.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna study.
Yeah.
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load
down by the riverside.
I'm gonna study.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down